made preparations to end my life.
For File on 4 Investigates, I'm finding out why one doctor dies by suicide every 3 weeks and what needs to change to prevent it. Medical Emergency on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Tuesday night at 8.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday, the 29th of August. This is Chris Aldridge. Good morning. Nepal has appealed for specialised foreign help to rescue people trapped in tunnels and identify and store bodies, days after devastating flash floods tore through the north of the country. At least 616 people are now known to have died in Nepal. More than 2,400 others are still missing there and over the border in Tibet, including 33 British nationals. Rescue efforts are being hampered by heavy rain, thick mud and poor communications. Our South Asia correspondent, Azadeh Mashiri, reports from Trishuli.
Rain is falling again across northern Nepal, and emergency teams are warning it's making it difficult to reach some of the worst affected areas. Wednesday's flood has swept away bridges and roads, and helicopters have been making relentless journeys back and forth to ferry survivors to safety. Thousands of people cut off from the rest of the country have been saved so far. In neighbouring India, authorities have said 7 bodies have been recovered from rivers flowing from Nepal, and they are believed to be victims of the flood. Here in Trishuli, the military have been issuing warnings of more possible flooding. There are fears a glacial lake formed of floodwater and debris near the Nepal-Tibet border could breach its banks.
A man has died and 6 people have been injured after a large sign fell in strong winds at a Christian festival in West Sussex. Police say the health and safety executive and local authority have been informed. Organisers have cancelled the big church festival, which had been due to run until Sunday. Our correspondent Duncan Kennedy sent this report from the scene near Stenning.
The festival was just getting underway when what appears to be a large blue sign came down on top of people. One eyewitness spoke of the confusion that followed among those nearby. Sussex police have confirmed that a 41-year-old man from Eastbourne has died. They say his next of kin have been informed and are being supported by specialist officers. 6 people were also injured and taken to hospital. The event is the largest Christian festival in Britain and has been going since 2009. The organisers said their thoughts and prayers were with all those impacted by the incident.
President Trump has announced a deal with Venezuela that gives the US majority control of more than 65 billion barrels of oil, about a fifth of the country's proven reserves. Mr. Trump claimed it would lower American petrol prices and boost prosperity in Venezuela, whose president, Nicolas Maduro, he ousted in January. Venezuela's interim leader, Delcy Rodriguez, said the deal was worth more than $300 billion in investment and tax revenue for her country. Ian McWilliam reports.
Donald Trump described his new deal with Venezuela as the biggest oil deal in world history. He said it would more than double U.S. oil reserves and substantially lower prices for U.S. consumers. Rising domestic fuel costs have been a primary concern of the president as the November midterms approach, and Iran continues to block shipments through the Strait of Hormuz. Media reports say that in return for a U.S. ownership stake, private companies, including American firms, would develop Venezuelan oil fields and return more oil revenue to Venezuela.
More than 30 families are calling on the government to stop killers convicted of any form of manslaughter being released early to ease prison overcrowding in England and Wales. The open letter has been signed by Emma Webber, whose son Barnaby was killed in the Nottingham attacks, and the BBC commentator John Hunt, whose wife and 2 daughters were murdered in a crossbow attack. The government says it's fast-tracking a plan to keep the most dangerous offenders behind bars. Immigration officers in the US have detained the British right-wing commentator Milo Yiannopoulos, accusing him of overstaying his visa. Mr. Yiannopoulos, an outspoken supporter of Donald Trump, was arrested at New Orleans Airport and is now facing deportation. That's the BBC News now for a look at the weather. Here's Stav Danaos.
Thanks very much, Chris. Good morning to you. Well, the bank holiday weekend for most of us looks quite unsettled across the UK, but there will be some sunshine at times too. Now, today we've got low pressure moving already across southwestern parts of the UK, and that'll spread northwards and eastwards. So England and Wales will see that rain spreading northwards and eastwards, some of it heavy, possibly thundery at times. Showers will follow late into this afternoon, and some of these will be heavy and thundery. A little bit of sunshine in between, temperatures 18 to 23 degrees. Winds will be light and variable for most, but it will be windy as that low moves in across southern counties of England and through the Channel. For Scotland, it's a bright start in places with a little bit of sunshine, but cloud and showers will tend to develop, particularly in the south and west. Northern areas should stay drier with some glimmers of sunshine continuing. Temperatures across Scotland, 16 to 20 degrees. For Northern Ireland, you'll start dry, but it will turn cloudy with rain and showers gradually moving eastward. Some of them could be on the heavy side. Temperatures for Northern Ireland around 16 to 19 Celsius. And the rest of the weekend into Bank Holiday Mini will stay unsettled with some heavy, possibly thundery showers. That's your weather.
Thank you, Stav. Now time for a look at today's papers. The FT Weekend leads with a report that the Chancellor, John Healey, will shelve his own target of spending 3% of economic output on defence by 2030 when he sets out his first budget in October. A government insider tells the paper that bigger decisions on an uplift in defence spending will be delayed until a Treasury review next year. But under the headline Surrender, the Daily Mail says Mr Healey has been branded a hypocrite, given he resigned as Sir Keir Starmer's Defence Secretary because he believed not enough was being spent on the military. Any delay will risk angering the United States, according to the Daily Telegraph, which says that Washington is looking at ways to incentivise the UK to increase defence spending. The paper says that one measure being considered is opposing British sovereignty over the Falkland Islands. As the Chancellor ponders his budget, a former economic adviser to Andy Burnham tells the Times that it would be stupid to raise taxes on wealth. Senior allies of the Prime Minister are reported to be calling for an increase in capital gains tax, but Lord Jim O'Neill says this would encourage entrepreneurs to leave the country. The Daily Express welcomes Mr Burnham's announcement that he will stay neutral in the vote on assisted dying. It says his commitment will bring relief to campaigners who back a change in the law. But The Guardian points out the PM has no wish to affect the process in either direction. Fergie's coming home is the headline in The Sun. It says that Sarah Ferguson is returning from exile after fleeing the UK when emails she'd sent to Jeffrey Epstein were revealed. The former Duchess of York has previously said her friendship with Epstein was a gigantic error of judgment. The front page of the Daily Mirror says the King has written to the families of the two police officers who were killed in the crash on the A66 last weekend. A royal source tells the paper that Charles was shocked by the devastating events. That's our look at the papers. We'll have more in the Today programme from 7 o'clock. Later this hour, we'll be looking at what crops farmers might grow in the future to cope with a changing climate. First, though, on Radio 4, it's time for Open Country, and this week Martha Carney is on a riverbank in Kent.
So welcome everyone today, and today we are walking from Yalding to Maidstone. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a really beautiful journey. We're going to have a few stops along the way. I'll go.
This
through the whole
is the start of a pilgrimage in Kent, not the traditional religious route to Canterbury. No, this is a new pilgrimage. All the way along the route of the River Medway. The idea is to celebrate it and to campaign to make it clean again. Around 30 people have gathered and they're spending a whole week to trace the route of the river all the way to the sea.
So what we are doing today, we'll be starting walking from here and we'll also be having a short ceremony of recognition at the confluence of the Watering Bree stream. Then we'll continue walking to the confluence of the River Luce, which is just before Maidstone, so we'll do another ceremony there together.
The sound of one of the leaders blowing into a conch shell, and that means we're off. This section of the pilgrimage is from Yalding to Maidstone. Guy Hayward set up the British Pilgrimage Trust back in 2014. And Guy, just tell us a bit more about what's going to be happening today.
Well, we're walking along a river and it started a few days ago at the source of the River Medway and ultimately will end as it meets the North Sea But there are a lot of dimensions to this journey. There's the inner journey of what people go through as they walk along a river for days and days, and how that changes them. But then there's also this outer journey that they're trying to do, both walking along the path, but also trying to campaign for the health of this river. There are many different ways of campaigning, and they're going to be doing things like a conference with farmers and landowners and councillors and politicians to try and gather support. So there's that, and there's also the kind of practical, how do you clean it up now? Picking up the litter and also measuring the health of the river. And then there's the spiritual side, which is chanting and making offerings with like leaves with all the different bits of nature that people have picked up to represent their journey and offering it to the river. I love that side of this. You know, so for so long, pilgrimage has been maybe seen as something which is an inner, you know, what can it do for me? And this journey includes that, but also brings in, well, what can we do for it? How do we help our natural world?
Now, people will have heard of the famous pilgrimages, the one to Canterbury, but there are more and more modern pilgrimages, aren't there?
There are, and I think this reflects a kind of a desire to help with this nature disconnection. A lot of people have nature deficit disorder these days, and there's also a sense of a meaning and a purpose crisis, that what am I doing with my life? And perhaps people have got burnout, they're depressed, or they've lost someone, or there's just so many reasons for why you can do a pilgrimage. Some people are spiritual but not religious, some people are atheists, some people are Christian and pagan, Buddhist. We say bring your own beliefs at the British Pilgrimage Trust.
How many pilgrimages are there in this country now, would you say?
Well, we've got about 250, maybe more, on our website. Of those 250, we've got different kinds. There are traditional routes of the medieval shrine to shrine, you know, going to Canterbury or Walsingham or St David's, Iona, Lindisfarne, that kind of classic pilgrimage. But you've also got river pilgrimages, like today, ancestor pilgrimages, walking back to where your ancestors are buried. But also these day pilgrimages to cathedrals, you know, from walking outside in the countryside into a city and ending up at a cathedral.
We can see in the distance now the start of the walk with the banner that's being held, the Friends of Medway pilgrimage. Now, what are those sounds?
It's basically the group has got a little bit elongated. There's quite a bit of a gap, and so those at the back call to the front, and then they wait until we catch up. Well, it's difficult with the brambles here. Oh, wow. I mean, the main metaphor of the river, which I think is the most powerful, is you start at this kind of little spring-like, this crystalline trickle of water, like a sort of newborn baby with their eyes wide open, you know, like looking at the new world, and it's like pure. And then as you go down the river, these tributaries come in, like influences, like teachers and parents, like you have all these influences in your life. And then as you go along, your experience widens and grows, and then eventually it meets the sea when you perhaps die, and the river dies into the ocean. But it doesn't really die, because then those same water particles evaporate up, and then it starts all over again. And it feels like you're walking the birth to death metaphor actually in the land, and it grounds that reality in you very strongly. And I think that's what's going on underneath that I love so much.
So it's a way of celebrating the British landscape, isn't it?
It is, really, and I think it's a way of finding belonging. I think people, the more time they spend in the virtual world, in the internet and virtual reality, the more we need to actually ground ourselves in actual land and experience the absolute beauty and joy of nature expressing itself in all its different ways.
We've stopped by a bridge over the River Medway, where the Waterbury stream joins the Medway, and this is where the pilgrims on the walk are holding a ceremony. They call it a ceremony of recognition. One by one, they bring flowers that they've gathered on the walk, or leaves, and place them in the centre of the ring.
And let us call in together all of the tributaries of the Medway that we have met so far on this pilgrimage in the beautiful Medway, and all of the sacred waters that you're connected to. And let's call that golden light down from the source of the Medway and flow it to this point together. Beautiful, beloved River Medway. Thank you. chain that you bring.
Carry the wisdom from source to the sea. Listen to the medway, she's humble and free. Breathe in and breathe out, she's got what you need. She holds her breath and answers, she'll quietly. She'll carry the winter from source to the sea.
And music plays an important part, doesn't it, on many pilgrimages?
Yeah, everyone has their gift, I suppose, artistically, and what they can bring to a pilgrimage. I love singing folk songs and also sacred songs that create a sense of peace and love. And I think there's something about singing which brings people together. It dissolves barriers. So if you want to create a sense of oneness in a group, getting them singing is the best thing you can do, really. And also there's something about singing which is like enchanting. You know, a big part of this movement, this new pilgrimage movement in the last 10 years or so, is we're trying to re-enchant the landscape. And the best way to re-enchant is to chant. It's like casting a spell.
Breathe in and breathe out, she's got what you need.
A really important part of the pilgrimage is looking at the health of the river, campaigning for the cleanliness of the river. And that's why all along the route, some of the pilgrims, specially trained, take samples of river water.
Okay.
So you've gathered some water out of the river. Just explain to me what you're doing now.
So we're taking a water sample just below each confluence so we can see how the Medway is affected by whichever tributary flows in.
So I'm watching Vanessa from Whitstable close up to see how she's doing the monitoring.
So first of all, we have to just wash out the little test tubes, just give them a little clean. So we have 4 drops of this one, which is ammonia mid-range reagent A. Give it a little shake. And then I'm going to add 4 drops of this one, which is Nestle reagent B. 1, 2, 3, 4. The one that Adresa is doing, they're slightly more reactive chemicals, so she's wearing safety gloves.
Yeah. And what are you measuring, Eddie?
I'm measuring the phosphate levels.
This is blue fluid going into the test tube now.
Mm-hmm. And give it a shake.
And we put it back in the tester. Shut the thing, hold the button down. And then the ammonia takes 3.5 minutes to get the results, and the phosphate takes 5 minutes. So we leave those there, and in the meantime we'll go and take a map point of where we are so that we can record the results, and I'll show you how we've been building up our data collection.
Lucilla Newell is the lead for this operation. It's called Ripple Effect. And who do you work with?
Ripple Effect is a partnership between the University of Sussex and Friends of the River Medway.
And what is it you're measuring in the river?
We are measuring ammonia, phosphates, temperature and conductivity. And we also use Riverfly, which is looking at the invertebrates that tell us about the water health.
Why is it important to measure phosphates and ammonia?
Because the river is being polluted mainly by 3 things: sewage, agricultural runoff and road runoff. And ammonia and phosphates look at the first 2 especially.
So what have you found out about the health of the River Medway so far?
That it is in a poor state of health. We kind of knew that in general, but we know now what's happening in each individual stretch. And with Moniton, we have managed to make changes to push Southern Water and the EA to...
Environment Agency.
The Environment Agency to look at some of the spillages that they didn't know they were happening even. So we have the science, we have the back of the university, and they started to listen, and now we have a relationship where they actually pay attention.
There's definitely some life on the river because the mallards, the ducks, are joining in. Thank Let's you. Go and see if the results are through yet.
So the results are in for the Wateringbury confluence. The ammonia reading is 0.28 parts per million and the phosphate is 2.5. So those are significantly higher than we've been having further up the river.
Lucilla, what do you make of these results?
I think that the phosphates look really high, so there will be some agricultural runoff probably and maybe some treatment of the waters as well. If you have phosphates above 0.1, we are starting to harm the wildlife, and that's what we are looking at. What is the effect of these phosphates? You need a whole year to build a baseline, and that's what you have to do before you kind of jump to conclusions, I think, to understand the health of the river.
We've just walked past a long row of boats, people enjoying the river, and I've come to this spot to talk to Xavier Page, who helped set up Friends of the River Medway, I think around 6 years ago, and she now runs the pilgrimage. And how's it going so far, do you think?
It's going really well. We're on the fifth day and everyone's spirits are very high. I think the last few days have been a gentle, really an opportunity for people to form a gentle, quiet connection with the river as we've been in more rural areas. And now the energy is starting to build as we're moving towards Maidstone and people are just bubbling away with excitement for what's ahead.
And what difference does it make, do you think, walking along a river like this, starting at the source?
I think it's a really beautiful opportunity to get people to really get to know their local water source. And even if it isn't their local water source, just being able to be by a river for that amount of time, you start to build an awareness of where our water truly comes from. And I can speak for myself that just over 7 years ago, I had no idea where my water came from. I had no idea where it went. I didn't even know the name of my local river, despite it having flowed through my garden. And doing this pilgrimage from source to sea last year helped me understand the ecosystem that I was actually trying to connect with. It helped me see how this small trickle of a stream could turn into this wider, great expanse of a river. I think there's also an opportunity to actually connect more deeply with nature, not just the river through this, because you start to see things in the ecosystem like kingfishers, the amount of kingfishers that we've seen and the sense of awe and wonder that people experience when they have that. And these are really...
And they just don't look like they should fit in the English countryside.
They just
either.
Don't.
They're such bright colours.
They are, these emeralds.
Tropical.
Absolutely. It is funny. We actually saw one a few days ago and someone was like, no, it's a plastic bag. It can't be a kingfisher, you know. But it was one, luckily. But I think it's that sense of awe and wonder and recreating that for people that often are just in the general humdrum of their lives. And we are living in quite challenging times. So to be able to remember the magic that exists for us is really important. And beyond that inward change that can occur through that, the actual act of walking enables us to start spot the areas of distress. So we can see where the Himalayan balsam is there in higher numbers, which is an invasive species. We can see where different tributaries come in and what type of quality of water they're coming in. We want to keep building the story of we're here for something more than just us. We're here for something more than just going on a beautiful journey through the countryside. We're here to be in service to the river. And the citizen science helps ground the fact that the river isn't healthy and that's why we're walking.
How important was nature in your own childhood? I see your mother's here on the pilgrimage today.
Yes, both of my parents have been nature lovers and definitely introduced me to nature in that way. So nature's always been a fundamental part. I think the difference is, in the last few years, I've actually actively tried to create a relationship with nature. And so my mum always revered nature in her own way, and she wasn't religious, but she would say, if anything, nature was her God. And I grew up with that way of thinking, but I think you can still feel quite far removed from nature, even if that's introduced to you as a concept.
And you mentioned both your parents. Your father is Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin, and he's talked quite a lot about his own love of nature.
Definitely. I think the love of nature permeates his work. I mean, a lot of their songs have references to nature. And from the very first beginnings, I was actually born to the rain song. So it's definitely existed there from the beginning. Yeah.
There are 5 days left for the full pilgrimage, the full 70 miles. I'm going to be peeling off, but I'm interested to find out a bit more about the history of pilgrimages, and that's something that Dawn Champion knows all about from the British Pilgrimage Trust. And when did they really
begin in this country?
Well, a lot of people will automatically think of Becket and Chaucer when you use the word pilgrimage, but we would argue that they start in prehistory. As soon as you have people making journeys through the landscape, which are to spiritual destinations, places like Stonehenge and Avebury, making journeys for reasons other than the practical, and actually the River Medway is crossed over by the Pilgrim's Way, that follows a Neolithic track which you can traverse all the way down through the south of England off to those places. So it starts very, very early. But later on in history, you have the Romans. They would have been making pilgrimage. I mean, Aquae Sulis in Bath is sort of one of the most famous Roman spiritual destinations. The Anglo-Saxons were big fans as well. They were making these big, long, epic journeys all the way off to Rome. So they had to come through the English landscape first before that could happen. It sort of becomes much more of a universal practice in the medieval era. But really, the heyday of pilgrimage happens with the murder of Thomas Becket, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury. Henry II made his own penitential pilgrimage, but you also then had sort of the big heads of state coming from Europe. You had pilgrims coming from as far as Asia to come and visit Becket's shrine. So from that, this sort of massive culture of pilgrimage happens in this country, where sometimes it was about penance, a lot of the time it was about healing. People might be familiar with the tales of Chaucer, where it starts to verge into tourism. But pilgrimage continues up until 1538, when Henry VIII, rather unhelpfully, banned pilgrimage. It became illegal. He dismantled all of the infrastructure that would enabled people to make journeys through the landscape by being able to stay at the abbeys and the priories along the way. And at that point, pilgrimage really goes underground. We only sort of tend to see a revival of the practice as we would understand it in the 20th century.
Really, as late as that?
But by the time you get to 1913, one of the women's suffrage societies actually had a protest pilgrimage where they converged from across the country onto London to ask for the vote. You know, they actively used the word pilgrimage on their banners and on their little pin badges and things like that. But in terms of people making spiritual journeys, that sort of really started to kind of happen in the 1980s a little bit more. And we've seen in the last 10 years, it's just really, it's been extraordinary how it seems to have taken off in this country.
Well, we've reached the final part of today's stage of the river pilgrimage, and I'm sitting by the edge of the River Medway in the centre of Maidstone, the county town of Kent, and there are boys to my right who are fishing, there are cyclists coming by, lots of pigeons, lots of families out enjoying the river. Now, some of the pilgrims dip in and out, just come for the day. Others are what's known as core pilgrims, in for the long haul. And Olivia Hemmings is one of them. How's today been for you?
It's been amazing, yeah. Today, actually, I've started to get a bit sore, because this is maybe day... I've lost all sense of time and what day it is, but I think it's day four, and I start getting a bit achy today. But it's been beautiful, and the weather's been amazing. It's been, yeah, so sunny every day. And we've kind of gone from the slightly dreamy countrysidey bits into the town now, so we're seeing a different aspect of the Medway today.
And what drew you to doing this pilgrimage, because you work at a school in inner city London?
Yeah I do. So it's quite hard to put into words actually what drew me. It was more of a feeling. I'm from the countryside, but I've been living in London for the last year or so it's so important for me anytime I have off to be completely immersed, and this is the perfect way to do that.
And earlier in the day we heard you singing the most beautiful song, which you yourself wrote.
Yeah. So a week or so before the pilgrimage, Sophia sort of invited us to start tuning in with the river. And while I was marching up and down the streets of London, this little song started to sort of percolate in my brain. It kind of took form. It almost feels like it sort of came from the River Medway as a little gift to me, and I sort of channeled it. Rather than me writing it specifically, it's a bit more of a collaboration with nature, which is the way I like to write my songs. So it's been really beautiful to be able to like gift that to the pilgrims, and we've been singing all the way down as we've been walking, so it's been lovely, yeah.
Somebody's been doing the pilgrimage every day is Laura Hayward, and you may also have heard your drum, Laura, that you've been beating all the way through. Why did you decide to come on the pilgrimage?
I was able to come last year in a dropping in and out, and this year I wanted to do it from the beginning to the end. Last year it was such a changing experience. You feel the change as you're walking, that it opens you up and you're in flow with nature. You're part of the river and it you just flow with it. And it felt so intermittent last year with the gaps where I was only able to do the afternoons. So this year it's been a real joy and pleasure and a deep reverence with the river to be able to walk this far with it. I've walked home. I'm basically walking home from the source to Rochester. I live in Rochester, and this year it's been truly magical.
Due to copyright issues, we're having to find a very old song that is definitely out of copyright. So I've chosen this 13th century Around by a group of nuns from Reading Abbey, who wrote this song about summer coming in, but it's in Middle English, and you can join in. Sing cuckoo, no, sing cuckoo, sing cuckoo, no, sing cuckoo, no, sing cuckoo. Sing cuckoo. Summer is a coming in, Lord, I sing cuckoo. Crow has said a bloweth mead and sink the wood anew. Spring cuckoo. Awa bletteth after lumluth after calvecoo. The folk songs that come from the land, that you can find where they were collected from and which places they are singing about, it is a really good way of connecting people to the landscape. Summer is a coming in, Lord, I sing cuckoo. Crow has said and bloweth mead and sing the road anew. Song is a great way of bringing us back in communion with nature. Bullock starteth, book averteth, moor you sing cuckoo.
Well, I have to say that my feet are quite sore now, so I'm going to peel off. I can't make it all the way to the sea, but that's such an inspirational thought. Thank you, Guy, and to everybody else on the Medway Pilgrimage.
Open Country was presented by Martha Carney and produced by Emma Campbell. And later this morning, Doctors Chris and Zan van Tulleken unpack the benefits of walking and ask whether modern life's stopping us from moving enough. What's Up, Docs is at 9:30.
On BBC iPlayer.
There is a problem. A British contractor was shot in Svalbard up in the Arctic Circle.
Put down the gun!
This is DCI Silver.
I know who she is.
We have to keep things contained.
They go to war over this.
This is not the fight you can win.
The Russians are here, and it looks like they've come mob-handed.
Let's all stay calm. Okay, no one needs to get hurt. We need backup.
Amy, no!
The new series of Vigil starts tomorrow on BBC iPlayer.
Really looking forward to that. And there are series 1 and 2 available now on BBC iPlayer. Well worth it if you haven't seen them. This is BBC Radio 4, now Farming Today this week with Anna Hill.
Good morning. Today, what we can learn from a massive blue tongue outbreak in the Netherlands.
The will to vaccinate was a lot higher in 2025, especially for cattle farmers. And we didn't see any cases in 2025, luckily. And we're now the end of August 2026, and we haven't seen any cases either yet.
How an old favourite of gardeners is finding a new life.
It's finding a whole range of uses now. For example, bedding, some farmers locally that use it for bedding. It's used in building. It's also used in the production of compost.
And the smell of summer at a lavender farm in the Lake District.
This is actually French lavender. It's called Lavande in Grosso. It's basically the same plant that's grown in Provence because it yields the most oil.
I can smell it now. Very summery. But we start this week away from the heady aroma of lavender because most farmers have their feet firmly on the ground, contemplating a tough future as they face flood, drought and heat waves, not to mention price rises, war and disease. So this week we've been asking what innovations are happening to make farming more resilient for the future. While much of the work on crops is using gene editing, scientists are also reassessing new uses for them as well. Dr. Lydia Smith is head of the Innovation Farm at NIAB, the National Institute of Agricultural Botany. She told Charlotte that scientists can help by tweaking current crop varieties to cope better.
The breeders can get in there and really address whether a crop can be drilled early. And those ones that don't like early we can make them more able to withstand cold conditions. So that's been the case with soybean, and it's been the case with maize. So you've seen maize marching up the countryside. And then we can look at some real new ones. So I would never have believed you if you'd said to me 10 years ago, we're going to be growing chickpea and lentils in England. But we are. And they're very happy in these hotter, sunnier, dry conditions. So we don't need to just look at breeding. We can actually look at completely new species and then look at how we can tweak those a little bit to make them suitable for our environment. And I think let's go back and look at some of the old rediscovered crops. Let's take sainfoin, for example, which is a lovely forage legume. If you look at a picture of a farm where I often do some work in Oxfordshire, there is one field that is standout green, even now when we still had no rain. And that's the sainfoin field. So if you were a livestock producer and you were clever or lucky enough to have sainfoin in your armoury, you would still have forage now, unlike those farmers that have been relying on crops that are purely grass-based.
What about the banker crops, if you like? Wheat, barley, oilseed, rape. Are we looking at new varieties of those? Or are we going to be really looking at phasing them out?
Oh, I don't think we're going to phase them out. I mean, I think work that's been done at NIAM and elsewhere to really look at the originating genetics of these is giving us crops that are very resilient and more drought resistant, you know, deeper roots, better able to deal with these difficult conditions. So I think we're going to be looking at new varieties coming through from all sorts of clever breeding methods. And let's not reject gene editing as one route to that. But I think we want a broader rotation. I think wheat rape as a rotation was a little bit bonkers. And let's look at things like white millet. This is another exciting new species that's coming through, incredibly drought resilient due to its deep roots, and probably would be initially rejected by a lot of public because what do we want to eat millet instead of wheat? It's not so tasty. But I think, you know, there's lots of ways that we can deal with that, and we can cook it differently and prepare it differently so that it's just as delicious as food that are made with the old traditionals. But yes, we do need the infrastructure and we need that marketplace.
Some new ideas there from Lydia Smith from NIAP. Well, as we've just heard, gene editing can now legally be used to adapt crops to meet the challenges of climate change. Not everyone is in favour, and there are calls for such food to be labelled, which it currently isn't. Since Brexit, the UK has continued to develop gene editing innovations, and it's also been negotiating with the EU over allowing these crops into member states. This summer, the European Parliament voted and agreed to deregulate gene-edited crops. However, they also decided that plants with complex or transgenic modifications, GMOs, should still be restricted. So what's the difference, and will the decision help British scientists and farmers? I asked Professor Pete Eastman from Rothamsted Research.
The key difference is that in genetically modified organisms, you're introducing genetic material, genes from one organism into another, where the organism you're obtaining the gene from is different from the organism you're putting it into. So GM crops are crops where foreign genes have been introduced into the plant.
And gene editing or precision breeding, how different is that?
So gene editing is part of a set of technologies that you can use to make genetic changes in a targeted way in a plant. So the bottom line is that if you don't introduce foreign genes in doing that, then the crop is not considered to be genetically modified now in the UK under the Precision Breeding Act and regulations.
What is allowed then into the EU after this decision has been made?
In a couple of years' time, it will be possible to put forward crops to be grown commercially that contain genetic changes that have been introduced by gene editing technologies, where the regulations will be much lighter touch and they won't be the same as a GM crop.
Professor Peter Eastman from Rothamsted Research. Well, millions of pounds are being invested in precision breeding programmes across the UK. A team from Wild Bio in Abingdon, that's a spin-off company from Oxford University, have turned their attention to gene editing wheat. Our reporter Howard Shannon joined CEO Dr. Ross Hendren in one of their laboratories.
Well, Ross and I have come into one of the refrigerated areas of the research lab here. So this is a round culture tray inside. Tell me what we're looking at here then.
In this dish, you are looking at wheat calli. So these started life as an immature embryo that the team would have harvested from an ear of wheat. And for each one of these, they'd have carefully put them on the plate and induced what you're seeing now, which is this kind of cloudy, fluffy structure. Once they grow, they'll produce seeds. And from those seeds, everything is hopefully edited. We'll check for that, make sure it's doing what we hope it's doing. And then we'll move through generations and ultimately get those out into the field so we can start testing them.
Well, Ross and I are joined by Rona Costello, sort of the team lead when it comes to looking at traits of wheat. Tell me how they've got to be there and what qualities in nature you're looking for.
Yeah, so we're really interested in traits that will improve the resilience of our crops to some of the stresses that they're facing, especially with extreme weather events. And the approach we take is to say, well, actually, plants have been evolving independently on the many branches of evolution, right? And evolution will have come up with many solutions to some of the challenges that our crops are facing, whether it's resilience to high temperatures or sustained productivity under drought stress. But the challenge is that evolution has come up with those solutions in wild plants, not necessarily in our crop plants. So the approach we take is to look into that evolutionary data and understand what are the genetic changes that mean that plants have adapted to survive in these extreme or difficult conditions, and then how do we take those genetic changes and put them into our crop plants.
Okay, well, let's leave this room a second, because it's a lovely hot day outside. It's actually quite chilly in here. Now, Rona, some trials have been underway for some time now in Essex. Talk me through what you found there.
Yes, we've had our plants with enhanced photosynthetic productivity in field trials for the last 3 years. And exactly, we've had a whole range of climatic conditions. So in some ways, it's been a really good test bed for our traits. And what we've seen consistently over those 3 years is yield improvement. It does vary by year, but we have seen at times more than 20% improvement across particular yield traits. But one thing that's really interesting that we have seen is that our enhanced plants often have an early vigor phenotype. So they establish a little bit faster early in the growing season and they reach canopy closure sooner. And that's so that might actually be helping those plants to be more resilient early in the growing season.
Dr. Ross Hendren and Rona Costello there. Well, sometimes finding more resilience involves making better use of what we already know. And one plant that seems to have coped really well in this year's drought and heat is a gardener's old favourite, elephant grass, or miscanthus. Scientists at Aberystwyth University have been studying the uses and climate credentials of miscanthus for some years now. Dr. Paul Robson is from the university's Institute of Biological, Environmental and Rural Science, and he's been talking to our reporter, Marie-Claire Carey-Jones.
Wow, this crop is incredible. It's bright green and it's about 8 feet tall, I'd say. You're pretty tall and it's towering above you, Paul.
And it's providing some nice shade for us on a very hot day. When we look around, we see parched areas of land, but this is still green, it's still growing.
So how is that? How is this crop doing so well when nothing else around you seems to be?
So it's got really deep roots. It's got rhizome, which to some extent buffers growth. It allows it to continue growing. And also we've bred varieties that are quite efficient at using water.
So what are you hoping that this crop might be used for?
Initially, we really thought of the crop as being used for bioenergy, straw-fired power stations, for example. But it's finding a whole range of uses now. For example, bedding, some farmers locally that use it for bedding. It's used in building. So around Schiphol Airport in the Netherlands, there's lots of miscanthus in structures around there. It's also used in the production of compost.
And how does it compare cost-wise to comparable crops like straw and hemp?
So because it's perennial, there's an upfront cost. So it's about £2,000 a hectare to establish the crop. It needs a little bit of TLC to get it going. But then once you get to a mature canopy like this one, it pretty much looks after itself. So you don't have to feed it, you don't have to do any weeding. You can pretty much just come back once a year and harvest it. So once you get over that cost of establishing the crop, then it's very minimal.
And if we wander along here, we're sort of between two rows of miscanthus, but then next to us on the right, there is an open patch without any of the crop. Why has that been left here?
So that's been left here so that we can compare soil carbon as it would be without miscanthus against soil carbon with miscanthus in it. So slowly over time, it builds up the soil carbon reserves. And it does so because it's got the rhizome in there, it's got extensive root systems, and also the leaf that's dropped. That all contributes to carbon within the soil. And it gives sort of shelter to nature. So, you know, there's more earthworms in miscanthus plots than there are in plots of wheat, for example. It's not as biodiverse as a wildflower meadow, for sure, but you know, it's economically active and has all of these benefits associated with it.
Dr. Paul Robson with Marie Claire Carey-Jones. Well, now to another of this year's summer challenges, disease. Blue tongue is still spreading rapidly across the country. There are around 700 cases now, where each case is a farm, not an individual animal. The biggest concentration is in the southwest, but it's also reached Scotland for the first time. There are no cases in Northern Ireland. The disease is spread by midges. Symptoms include ulcers and swelling in the mouth, lameness and birth defects. It doesn't affect humans or the food chain. As well as the distress caused by the disease itself, there have been difficulties getting hold of the vaccine because of demand, and the testing system is backed up. The government this week opened a second lab to help out. Well, in Scotland, temporary movement restrictions have come in to help stop the spread. But Scotland's deputy chief vet, Jesus Galeggio, told Charlotte that immunisation is the only way to stop the disease completely.
The long-term strategy for containing and dealing with the effects of blue tongue is vaccination. It's the only measure that is effective once that the virus is circulating in the midge population, because at that point, any measure based on movement controls or culling is no longer effective. So the purpose of our strategy, as agreed with our stakeholders in Scotland, is to slow down the progression of disease, to try to keep it levels as low as possible and as contained geographically as possible, to give the industry time to vaccinate and to be prepared as and when the disease potentially spreads further.
So this is why we've seen these movement restrictions around the cases, but also why you're saying if you're taking an animal into the blue tongue zone, which is England and Wales, you have to bring it back the same day.
Generally speaking, animals that come from the restricted zone into Scotland need to be subject to some control measures, including testing and vaccination. But we're making exemptions for animals that originate from the Scottish free area that go to the restricted zone in England, as long as they return on the same day.
And this is going to have an impact because of the time of year, because we see a lot of sheep in particular, because of the ram sales, travelling around the country.
This is particularly bad time for the southwest of Scotland, given the expected number of animal moves that would take place at this time of the year.
Is there any extra advice because you've got these sales going on? I mean, were you tempted to say actually best not to have them at all?
In terms of sales and movements, talk to your auctioneer. They have up-to-date information and they'll be able to make a decision on which type of sales can go ahead and under what conditions.
So some might not go ahead then?
It will be a commercial decision between farmers and auctioneers. We have done as much as we can with them to facilitate the completion of the sales that were planned in the short term. But ultimately, it will be for markets and their customers to comply with the license conditions and to decide whether they are first able to comply with them, and second, whether they are still in their commercial interest to continue.
Scotland's deputy chief vet. Well, this is the worst blue tongue outbreak we've seen in the UK, exacerbated by the hot weather. But its impact has been felt across Europe over many years. One of the worst outbreaks was in the Netherlands in 2023, affecting an estimated 5,000 farms before the vaccine was developed for this strain of the virus. Margit Groeneveld is a Dutch veterinary specialist in small ruminants. She told me what happened back in 2023.
From the first week of September in 2023, it started spreading mostly northwards. That's just the wind direction, mainly the wind direction that it was going into. And apart from it being in the shock that we all of a sudden had it, it was also a very, very pathogenic virus strain. So it made especially sheep very, very sick. And it caused a very high mortality rate in the animals that it did affect as well. And because it was still peak season for the midges, it spread quickly and it spread pretty far, not the full country, but it did. It continued spreading until about December in 2023. It affected mainly sheep and cattle, affected some goats, but especially the sheep farmers were struck really, really hard. We had case fatality rates of 75%. So every sick animal that got sick, sheep, that is 75% of those died. And we had flocks that had 80 and sometimes 100% of their animals affected. And then in December, it sort of died down with the end of the mid-season.
At that time in 2023, there was no vaccine. But when the vaccine did come in, how did that change things?
A few companies, three, started developing a vaccine immediately. And we had three vaccines available, one in at the start of May 24, and then two more at the end of May 2024. So we could start vaccinating. Unfortunately, we probably weren't able to start vaccinating early enough. And also not everyone had vaccinated in the south that hadn't been affected as badly. There were still people who thought, oh, well, it will just blow over and it won't affect my farm. And then unfortunately, they were wrong, because in the first week of July 2024, it just turned up all over the country. All of a sudden, everywhere, it seemed to have overwintered, especially in cattle. And then it had reinfected the whole midge population in the beginning of 2024, or the spring of 2024. And then it had been able to just infect the whole population. And then we actually had a pretty bad year again in 2024, unfortunately.
What's happened now?
Yeah, so in 2024, people got really scared because it was all over the country, both in cattle and in sheep. We didn't see the same fatality percentages. So sheep were a little bit more likely to survive. The survival rate was around 80%, 80 to 90%. They developed natural immunity. And because the whole country, both sheep and cattle farmers, had seen the virus again in 2024, the will to vaccinate was a lot higher in 2025, especially for cattle farmers. And we could start vaccinate a lot earlier, so we could vaccinate because the vaccines were available. And we didn't see any cases in 2025, luckily. And we're now the end of August 2026, and we haven't seen any cases either yet.
Dutch vet Margriet Groeneveld. Well, let's end with something a little more relaxing. Lavender in the Lake District. There are around 50 farms across the UK growing lavender as part of their cropping, often as a diversification, some with up to 100 acres of plants, while others are on a much more modest scale. And although we often associate this fragrant shrub with hotter climes like Provence in the south of France, it can thrive well in Britain. When Sandy Thornton started growing it on her 30-acre farm in the south of the Lake District, some neighbours did raise a quizzical brow. But 2 years on, the lavender beds are getting established and there's a distinctly purple haze across part of Cumbria's Lith Valley. Kaz Graham has been to take a good sniff.
Okay, so I'm basically going to harvest this. So I'm gathering it, almost like a sheath of corn, if you're trying to imagine it, but like a giant ponytail. And you just hold it underneath the plant and off you go with the hand shear. And round you go, and you just about get every single lavender bud in one go.
On a hot, sunny day like today, you can smell this farm before you actually see it. In fact, I met a man on the road while I was coming up here, and I said, do you know where the lavender farm is? And he said, follow your nose.
Just snipping off the last little bits there. Put it in a nice, neat pile to be collected at the side.
And this is one of your rows of lavender. How much lavender are you growing here now?
There's 5,000 plants at the moment. We probably will put some more in. It becomes a bit addictive.
And it's really striking, this lavender field. You don't really expect to see it on a Lake District hillside. Why are you growing lavender? Why did you think it would work here?
Basically, I had a little bit of experience growing lavender. And when we bought the farm, we were entirely new farmers, farmers without any equipment and really without any knowledge. And we were going, what can we do with that south-facing hill? So we thought we had to play to our strengths. So we put 35 plants in and did a micro test. And we put those in for 6 months and they were great. The soil itself was kind of perfect because it's not in good condition, yet it's absolutely chock-a-block rammed full of limestone, which is brilliant because it creates the right pH for the lavender. Coupled with it being on a south-facing slope, all those factors add up to this being a really unique field.
And looking at these lavender plants here, if we just walk along between the rows, they kind of look like the lavender plants that you might have in part of your garden. How did you research what lavender to grow? Because presumably there's lots of different varieties, aren't there?
Yeah, there's loads of different varieties. I mean, if you're commercially growing lavender, you need to grow something that you can use. So this is actually French lavender. It's called Lavandin Grosso. It's basically the same plant that's grown in Provence because it yields the most oil. Most of the field is planted for oil so that we can then make products afterwards. But we have another section that we're working on now, slightly over the hill, which is all culinary. But that's also prettier, and that's often English lavender because it's lower in camphor, which basically means it's easier to eat on the palate.
Well, we've come down to the farm buildings, lovely ancient stone-built farm buildings here. And there is a waft of lavender scent that is going through the air here. Actually, just before we go in, there's a cylindrical metal barrel, yeah, outside here. What is this?
This is the commercial still that's just arrived. So we're just in the process of building that.
It's a new still.
It's a new still because we've grown out of our original copper still that came from Portugal. So we're just in here looking at that now.
It's like a still that you get in a whiskey distillery, really, but just in miniature. And this is the liquid coming out.
That's the essential oil. It's very potent. We are basically collecting the oil to make lots of products with. Pure essential oil, grown and made and distilled in the Lake District.
Sandy Thornton there with her Lake District lavender, bees and butterflies. On Monday, I'll be travelling across North Norfolk following four projects involving dozens of farmers who've linked up to create landscape-scale changes to the countryside, improving habitats for nature and more sustainable ways of farming. But that's all from us today. I'm Anna Hill. The producer is Sally Challoner. Farming Today this week is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
Now on BBC Radio 4, let's go to Weekend Weather Outlook with Steph Danaos.
Thanks very much, Chris. Good morning to you. Yes, indeed, it's the weekend, a bank holiday for all but Scotland, and the weather is looking unsettled. We do need the rain, of course, but some of it will be heavy and thundery and could lead to some localised flooding like we have seen over the past couple of days with some torrential downpours. Now, we've got a new area of low pressure working its way in now as I speak across Wales, southwest England. It's moving off the Atlantic, and I'll start with England and Wales. We'll see that rain spreading northwards and eastwards across most of England and Wales as we head through the morning period. Some of it will be heavy, possibly thundery, like we have seen across Devon, Cornwall and in towards Wessex generally. Showers will follow later as we head into the afternoon across England and Wales, and some of them will be heavy and thundery, especially if the sunshine emerges. Now, temperature-wise, we're looking at 18 to 23 degrees, the warmest across the southeast, but winds will be strong today across southern counties of England, South Wales and through the Channel, so that will make it feel a little bit cooler with those blustery, strong westerly winds. For Scotland though, probably seen the best of the day's weather today. You'll be north of the low pressure system, so a dry start with light winds, any early mist and fog clearing, variable clouds, some sunny spells, and we're likely to hold on to that as we head into the afternoon. The best of the sunshine, northern and western Scotland. For Northern Ireland though, you're looking at cloudier conditions, a little bit of sunshine here and there, but there will be rain and showers gradually moving in from the east later in the day. Temperatures across Scotland and Northern Ireland, we're looking at 16 to 20 degrees. Now, tonight, showers will ease away from much of England and Wales as that low pressure pulls off into the North Sea. But Scotland and Northern Ireland will see a weather front pushing in, so you'll see the showers increasing here. Some of them will be heavy. Temperatures overnight across the UK, 11 to 16 degrees, so still quite mild. So we head into tomorrow then. Sunshine and showers will get going. Some of them will be heavy and thundery in northern and western areas. Best of any brightness in the southeast. And temperatures again, high teens, low 20s.
Staff Danaos, thank you. Now, throughout this coming Thursday, Radio 4 will be going back in time.
Normandy on BBC Radio 4.
1066, perhaps the most famous year in all of English history. And in a special edition of You're Dead to Me, we're exploring what led to the seismic Battle of Hastings.
Harold ends up in Normandy.
We don't know what. He's trying some croissants.
The story has it all. Multiple battles, an alleged illicit affair, and a lot of horses.
If you've got, say, 3,000 horses, how much poo do you think they would produce?
Join me, Greg Jenner, and my guests for You're Dead to Me, part of Normanday on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, this Thursday afternoon at 4.
This is BBC Radio 4.
Hello, it's 7 o'clock on Saturday the 29th of August. This is Today with Johnny Diamond and Henry Zeffman.
The headlines this morning: the number of people listed as dead or missing after the flash floods in Nepal and Tibet has risen sharply overnight as the search for survivors reaches a critical juncture.
Four figures emerge from a tunnel on the mountainside. They are all caked in thick mud. Bright yellow hard hats are the only thing that distinguishes the rescuers from the rescued.
The UK's biggest Christian music festival has been cancelled after a sign collapsed, killing one person and injuring six others. Donald Trump says he's struck a deal with Venezuela to give the US control over a fifth of the country's oil reserves.
Also in today's programme, after a week of violent incidents in Cleveland leave nine people dead, what's driving the disorder? The mayor of Middlesbrough gives us his assessment at 8:30. Swapping shops for homes, we'll explore solutions to breathe life back into our high streets. And right to the heart of Nashville, Tennessee.
Let's give her a great big welcome right now. Pretty Miss Dolly Parton. How about it?
There's no way that girl standing on the Hopper stage could have ever imagined what she was in for.
As the crown jewel of country music prepares to celebrate the life of Dolly Parton, we'll hear from the man hosting one final hurrah.
And I'm Jonathan Edgard with your Saturday Sport. As Joe Root's England team take control of the second test against Pakistan, I'll be talking to the former captain, whose words have put them on the brink of a first series win in 2 years.
The BBC News is read by Chris Aldridge.
Nepal has appealed for specialised foreign help to rescue people trapped in tunnels and identify and store bodies days after devastating flash floods tore through the north of the country. At least 616 people are now known to have died there. But officials in one district say many of the bodies they've recovered are no longer identifiable. The number listed as missing in Nepal has risen again to more than 2,400, including 33 British nationals. Rescue efforts are being hampered by poor weather, as our South Asia correspondent Azadeh Mashiri reports from Trishuli.
Rain is falling again across northern Nepal, and emergency teams are warning it's making it difficult to reach some of the worst affected areas. Wednesday's flood has swept away bridges and roads, and helicopters have been making relentless journeys back and forth to ferry survivors to safety. Thousands of people cut off from the rest of the country have been saved so far. In neighbouring India, authorities have said seven bodies have been recovered from rivers flowing from Nepal, and they are believed to be victims of the flood. Here in Trishuli, the military have been issuing warnings of more possible flooding. There are fears a glacial lake formed of floodwater and debris near the Nepal-Tibet border could breach its banks. But for now, the greatest danger has passed, leaving the country to confront the worst disaster Nepal has seen since an earthquake in 2015.
The UK is sending a specially trained crisis response team to Nepal to help support British nationals affected by the floods. The rapid deployment team will work alongside the British Embassy and local authorities to help people find information about missing relatives and liaise with rescue teams. In neighbouring Tibet, Chinese state media says the number of people killed has risen to 7, with more than 550 missing. Rescue operations there have restarted after they were paused because of fears of more flooding. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker is monitoring the situation from Beijing.
New footage from Chinese state media has revealed the scale of the destruction on the Tibetan side of the border. Rescue teams are shown wandering in a wasteland of mud and rock in what was once a bustling border crossing, calling out in the hope of finding survivors. A small team finally reached Girong Port between Nepal and Tibet yesterday afternoon after trekking over mountains, scaling cliff faces and crossing raging rivers. Rescuers told the state broadcaster that it was a scene of ruins covered only in thick mud. Water levels in a lake which formed in the debris of the landslide are reported to be rising once again. The command team in charge of rescue efforts have launched drones and set up observation posts to monitor the slopes and provide an early warning system to rescuers working nearby.
A man has died and six people have been injured after a large sign fell in strong winds at a Christian festival in West Sussex. Organisers have cancelled the big church festival, which had been due to run until tomorrow. Our correspondent Duncan Kennedy sent this report from the site near Stenning.
The festival was just getting underway when what appears to be a large blue sign came down on top of people. One eyewitness spoke of the confusion that followed among those nearby. Sussex police have confirmed that a 41-year-old man from Eastbourne has died. They say his next of kin have been informed and are being supported by specialist officers. Six people were also injured and taken to hospital. The event is the largest Christian festival in Britain and has been going since 2009. In a statement, the organisers said their thoughts and prayers were with all those impacted by the incident. Police have urged people with any information or relevant video footage to contact them.
President Trump has announced a deal with Venezuela that gives the US majority control of more than 65 billion barrels of oil, about a fifth of the country's proven reserves. Mr. Trump claimed it would lower American petrol prices and boost prosperity in Venezuela, whose president, Nicolas Maduro, he ousted in January. Venezuela's interim leader, Delcy Rodriguez, said the deal was worth more than $300 billion in investment and tax revenue for her country. Ian McWilliam reports.
Donald Trump described his new deal with Venezuela as the biggest oil deal in world history. He said it would more than double US oil reserves and substantially lower prices for US consumers. Rising domestic fuel costs have been a primary concern of the president as the November midterms approach, and Iran continues to block shipments through the Strait of Hormuz. Media reports say that in return for a US ownership stake, private companies, including American firms, would develop Venezuelan oil fields and return more oil revenue to Venezuela. The Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has said the deal would bring nearly $100 billion of private investment to Venezuela and support thousands of high-paying jobs there.
More than 30 families have called on the government to stop killers convicted of any form of manslaughter being released early to ease prison overcrowding in England and Wales. The letter's been signed by Emma Webber, whose son Barnaby was killed in the Nottingham attacks, and the BBC commentator John Hunt, whose wife and two daughters were murdered in a crossbow attack. Ministers are expected to set out on Tuesday how they intend to keep two of PC Andrew Harper's killers in prison after a public outcry. Our political correspondent Nick Eardley reports.
The government says an expansion of early release is essential to stop the prison system collapsing, but there's been scrutiny of who should be included. Andy Burnham ordered the Justice Secretary to find a way to keep PC Harper's killers in prison. But there are concerns others responsible for killings might still be released. This letter is signed by families who have been impacted by various cases. In some, the perpetrator would not be eligible for earlier release under new rules. But the families say that many victims feel they are being asked to bear the consequences of the prison capacity crisis, with a growing sense justice for victims is being compromised. They add that all forms of manslaughter should be excluded from the early release scheme. The government said it was fast-tracking a plan to keep the most dangerous offenders behind bars.
Immigration officers in the US have detained the British right-wing commentator Milo Yiannopoulos, accusing him of overstaying his visa. Mr. Yiannopoulos, a former editor of the conservative website Breitbart, is now facing deportation. Here's our North America correspondent Shaima Khalil.
U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, known as ICE, says Milo Yiannopoulos was arrested at New Orleans Airport and that he had chosen to overstay his welcome. The British citizen entered the United States legally in 2019. ICE says he failed to attend an immigration hearing and was issued with a final removal order last month. Mr. Yiannopoulos rose to prominence as a Breitbart editor and outspoken supporter of Donald Trump. He has backed the president's tougher immigration policies, although he recently said that Mr. Trump had lost his way. The self-styled provocateur has repeatedly attracted condemnation for inflammatory comments about Muslims, transgender people, feminists, and the Black Lives Matter movement. He once called himself the most fabulous supervillain on the internet. Mr. Yiannopoulos will remain in ICE custody pending deportation.
Officials at Nashville International Airport in Tennessee have proposed changing its name in honour of Dolly Parton. The singer, who died earlier this week, aged 80, was born in Tennessee and was closely associated with Nashville throughout her career.
Thanks, Chris. It's 9 minutes past seven, and the scale of the devastation in Nepal and Tibet is becoming clearer. Rescuers have reached the Girong port between the two cities for the first time and have found only ruins. The death toll has reached 626, according to local police, with more than 2,400 people still missing, among them 33 Brits. Our China correspondent, Laura Bicker, has been monitoring developments from Beijing. Good morning, Laura. And we know that the UK is among many countries, Canada, the US, the European Union, who have all announced that they're sending aid or financial support. Do we have a sense of how relief and rescue efforts are progressing this morning?
Well, when it comes to the Tibetan side of the border, yes, it does seem that finally rescuers have managed to reach what is really the epicentre of the disaster on the Chinese side, and that is Girong Port. That is that port building that you saw completely washed away by torrents of mud and water on Wednesday. It has taken them more than 60 hours to get there, and as you just mentioned, the only thing they've seen is ruins. There is footage of them in Chinese state media wandering through mud and water and bricks, and you can see that it looks like a complete wasteland, and they're calling out for survivors, but no one is replying. We've also seen footage, and again, this is the first time we've seen this, of Tibetan people pleading for their loved ones to come home and pleading to join the search and rescue efforts. It is brief footage, but it is there, but it's a glimpse of the disaster unfolding on that side of the border. We've also heard that the People's Liberation Army and others, engineers, are managing to get slightly closer and clear the road towards the port. And they say they can then help clearing the road towards Nepal. And they are also monitoring, remember that barrier lake that sits high up in the Himalayas? It's kind of nestling within the debris that was left behind in the landslide on Wednesday. But lake water has been rising. They're still continuing to monitor that. They say that the weather conditions in the last 24 hours have been horrendous, very wet indeed, but they've got a weather window now, a drier weather window, where they can get closer to that, the worst scenes of this disaster on the Chinese side.
And interesting, Laura, that you were talking there about footage being aired on Chinese state media, because for much of the past few days, the information that's been coming from the Chinese side, from Tibet, which is controlled by China, has been more limited, hasn't it? And the official death toll in Tibet is still just seven, much lower than the Nepal death toll, official death toll. Are we now getting more information out of the Chinese side?
Well, we're totally relying on Chinese state media. This is one of the most controlled areas of China. As a foreign journalist, I cannot go there without government permission, and that is very, very unlikely. So far, we've seen that even Chinese state media, which is also carefully controlled, reporters are managing to get closer alongside those specialist search and rescue teams, which is why information is then trickling through to us. But I must emphasise that Chinese state media is also carefully controlled. When it comes to the footage, I mean, I talked earlier about that footage of the Girong port being washed away. I mean, it's viral right around the world, except here in China. And now we're beginning to get stills of this area, which we can compare to last time. And you can see the devastation that this flood has caused. I think it's going to be many days before we know the exact toll. So far, what Chinese side is saying is that 554 people are missing, 260 of whom are said to be foreigners. Many of them were making a pilgrimage between Tibet and Nepal. We're also hearing that the Nepalese side has now decided to accept international assistance, particularly from China and South Korea, and particularly for their tunnelling and their 3D mapping and their technology that they do have. That's one of the things we do know about the Chinese side.
OK, Laura Bicker, our China correspondent in Beijing. Thank you.
The controversy over the government's plan to release some criminals from prison early to ease overcrowding refuses to go away. A group of more than 30 families have written to the Prime Minister to ask that anyone convicted of manslaughter be excluded from the early release scheme. The demand follows an outcry over the plan to release the killers of PC Andrew Harper. The government's expected to explain on Tuesday how that will now be avoided. Phil Kemp's our political correspondent. Let's talk about the letter. What's in it, Phil?
So this is a letter signed by campaigners, victims, organisations and families affected by killings, writing about what they call their deep concerns with how the early release scheme might be applied in those sorts of cases. Now, this was a scheme that was drawn up under Sir Keir Starmer to ease overcrowding in prisons. And it means some criminals will be released earlier than expected, in some cases after serving a third of their sentence, for others half of it. The government's already faced pressure over this when it was revealed that two of the killers of PC Andrew Harper were due to become eligible for early release next year. Yeah. He was the police officer who was killed, you'll remember, when he was dragged behind a getaway car while responding to a quad bike theft in 2019. Following a fierce public backlash, the government has said it's now confident it can find a way to make sure that they're not included. But the writers of this letter are calling on the government to ensure that everyone convicted of manslaughter is excluded from the scheme. They say there's a growing sense that justice for victims and public protection are being compromised in order to address pressures elsewhere in the system.
If you exclude those convicted of manslaughter, you're talking about keeping another 500 or so in prison. That is 500 places that the government then has to find from somewhere else. I mean, the tough decisions do not go away for the government. This is a crunch moment.
Yeah, this is shaping up to be one of Andy Burnham's first key tests as he returns to the Commons next week as Prime Minister. He's already announced a review of the scheme, which is now due to start rolling out from October. And earlier this month, the government announced that criminals found guilty of rape, serious child sex and other grooming offences would now not be included in it. The Conservatives have already forced the government to look again at this, though, after finding that some offenders, including those convicted of sexually assaulting children, could be freed early, and they want it stopped completely. So it's clear that the opposition see the government is vulnerable on this issue, and there are no easy choices when it comes to explaining to the public why some criminals are being let out of prison earlier than they otherwise would. A government spokesman said that they were fast-tracking a plan to keep the most dangerous offenders behind bars, and they'd inherited a prison system on the brink of collapse. They say they're building 14,000 new prison places, expanding electronic tagging, and exploring things like faster deportation of foreign criminals and exploring whether some women need to serve custodial sentences. And it's likely we'll hear announcements on this in the coming weeks.
Phil, thanks very much indeed. Phil Kemp, our political correspondent.
It's 16 minutes past seven. Sovereignty, the economy, fisheries, security, all familiar elements from British debates about our place inside or outside the European Union. But no, this is not an item about Brexit. Iceland is holding a referendum today on whether to resume talks on joining the EU 13 years after breaking them off. A recent opinion poll put the No campaign in the lead by a margin of, you guessed it, 52-48. Well, Ólafur Hardason is a professor of political science at the University of Iceland and joins us now. Good morning, Professor Hardason.
Good morning.
Now, Iceland is already part of the single market. It's part of the Schengen free movement zone. So how significant is this vote in going further for Iceland?
It is crucial to decide if Iceland should go further. But this referendum is on if we should continue negotiations, not on EU membership. if there will be negotiations and an agreement, then there will be another referendum on actually on membership.
And that's been part of the campaign, hasn't it? There's been an element of the Yes campaign, which is saying, well, let's vote yes in order to find out what deal we could negotiate from the European Union and then have the final say after that, hasn't it?
That, exactly. That is the main emphasis of the Yes side. They are pointing out that we are already an associate member of the EU through the European Economic Area Agreement. We are part of the common market. We are currently adopting around 75% of EU regulations already, but we have no voting rights, no representation, no seat at the table. And this, the Yes side is emphasizing this. Second, the Yes side is saying that membership, full membership, will bring economic benefits, lower interest rates, possibly the possibility to adopt to the euro. And third, and that is quite important, they are claiming, the Yes people are claiming that we may get a satisfactory solution on natural resources. They claim that the EU is showing signs of being flexible on fisheries and agriculture.
Well, let's talk about fisheries. I mean, I don't want to bring up the Cod Wars as a Brit speaking to you down the line to Iceland, but control of fishing waters has been at the heart of this, hasn't it?
What did you say?
Sorry, I was saying that I don't necessarily want to dwell on the Cod Wars because I know that the UK-Iceland relationship was marked by that, but control of Iceland's fishing waters has been the heart of the No campaign, hasn't it?
It has been one of the hearts of the No campaigns. The No campaign in many ways reminds one of the Brexit campaign in 2016. They have been emphasizing sort of hardline nationalism. They are claiming that membership means that we will lose control, lose our sovereignty, lose our independence. Second, they are claiming that the EU is a mess. Europe is declining while Iceland is doing extremely well in the last 10, 15 years. And third, they heavily emphasize that we will lose control of our natural resources, especially the fisheries and the agriculture. So you have very opposite sort of scenarios from the Yes side and the No side, what the future would look like if we joined the EU.
And just very briefly, if the Yes side wins and these negotiations do take place, do we have a sense of how quickly they could reach fruition?
That is, of course, not certain. But government ministers have been optimistic that this could be done in 1 or 2 years. Because, you know, we are already so much part of the EU.
Okay. All right. Well, Professor Oliver Hardison, we'll watch the results of the referendum with interest. Really appreciate you joining us this morning.
The fifth universal definition of myocardial infarction may sound a little baffling this early on a Saturday morning, but it is a big deal. It is a reclassification of heart attacks, in particular the kind of heart attacks that women suffer. And it's hoped that by reclassifying them, it will mean that those who have different kinds of heart attacks, those caused, for example, by a tear or by a spasm in the artery, will then receive more apposite interventions. Nick Mills is Professor of Cardiology at the Centre for Cardiovascular Science at the University of Edinburgh. He helped lead the international task force who devised the new heart attack definition. Alison Lawson experienced a heart attack when she was 53 by one of the causes that's now outlined in this new classification. Good morning to you both. I'm going to start, Professor Mills, with you, if I could. Why did you need to change the classification?
Good morning. Johnny. A real pleasure to be with you this morning.
Thank you.
As you know, heart disease is the world's biggest killer, and around 1 in 10 people will experience a heart attack. So getting the diagnosis right matters. And as you've already stated, we now know all heart attacks are not the same. And research led by the British Heart Foundation over the last 10 years has really helped to inform this new classification. It will provide a new framework that gives greater clarity about the underlying cause of heart attacks. And what we hope is that by implementing it around the world, it will guide more effective care.
So, forgive me, does it mean that what were thought to be minor heart attacks will then get more urgent treatment, more relevant treatment, or does it elevate what were thought to be more minor heart attacks to sort of major heart attack statements and status and mean that they are then taken that much more seriously?
That's exactly right. The latter point, really, that right. We now recognise that all different acute causes of a heart attack are equally important, including those that occur more commonly in women, and not just those that are caused by cholesterol and fatty and clots in the arteries. And our hope is that by elevating and recognising and explaining to patients the precise cause of their heart attack, it will lead to more tailored care and hopefully more informed research that will really optimise the way that we care for people with different causes of heart attacks.
Alison, you had what's known as a SCAD, which translates as a tear in the coronary artery. And that was what was thought to be a sort of rather more minor thing and is now being reclassified. Can you just tell us what happened to you and the kind of treatment that you received?
Yes, good morning. Thank you for having me on. So I was just going about my daily business, started to feel a bit of pain, a bit of pressure, felt a bit uncomfortable, rang 111, they sent an ambulance, and I was blue lighted to the cath lab where they discovered my SCAD through doing an angioplasty.
So it was discovered, I mean, and you were rather one of the sort of more fortunate victims, if I can phrase it like that. Were you aware at the time, or at least after the time, that it could have been missed?
Absolutely. It was lucky for me that the paramedic that saw me had seen a SCAD previously and wasn't quite comfortable with what was showing up on my ECG that they did, rang through to the hospital and spoke to cardiology, which is why they took me straight in. But it's not the case for a lot of patients. It gets missed because they think there's nothing showing on an ECG, so there's nothing wrong.
Professor Mills, I mean, this has a particular importance, doesn't it, for women's health? Because it was, as I understand, it was women and their heart attacks that were often being missed or sort of underdiagnosed.
Yeah, it's really important. There's a sort of perception that heart disease is something that men experience, but actually, it's almost as common in women, really. It's just women tend to develop heart disease later in life. And so particularly when a young woman like Alison presents, it's not often the forefront of people's mind. And this new definition is going to help in two ways. One, we're recommending now that we use a sex-specific blood test threshold, which will fundamentally reduce a systematic bias that's been present in our care for many years and reduce the risk of underdiagnosing heart attacks in women. And secondly, by promoting the causes of heart attack, like the one Alison experienced, SCAD, into the same framework, so all are considered important, will help encourage people to think about these causes earlier and hopefully, like Alison, get a prompt definitive test like an angiogram that allows treatment and improves survival. And I'm delighted that Alison got such a well-informed paramedic that was able to recognize that her symptoms were important, and she, it sounds like, received excellent care. And we now want that same excellent care for everyone.
Alison, how are you now?
Good days and bad days.
Right.
Get very fatigued sometimes. The reduction of a lot of medication that they send you home with for a standard heart attack helped.
Yeah.
I left hospital with 7 or 8 different medications for a standard heart attack.
Yeah.
And after seeing Professor Adlam, who is the leading SCAD specialist, I'm down to 2. And again, that's because a lot of the medical professionals are not aware of the treatment for SCAD, because there's no known cause for it to happen. So no actual physical treatment for it.
Mm. Alison, thank you so much for sharing your time and your experiences with us. Professor Mills, thank you so much indeed for explaining this fairly complex but hugely important subject. Thank you.
It's 27 minutes past seven, which means it's time for Jonathan Ledyard with today's sports news.
Morning. Manchester City may have changed managers, Enzo Maresca for Pep Guardiola, but their football continues to sparkle. Their 4-1 win at Crystal Palace last night made it two wins out of two. Top of the table for now. Palace are pointless and bottom under their new manager. Full coverage of the day's sport on 5 Live BBC Sounds from midday, including Joe Root's England cricket team, who've taken a commanding hold on the second test against Pakistan. Heading into the third day at Lord's, they'll resume on 81 for 3. That's a lead of 261 after Ollie Robinson and Jofra Archer shed 7 wickets. They dismissed Pakistan for just 110. So a first series win in almost 2 years is in the offing. We can talk to the man who gave the team talk before play started on Thursday, the former England captain, Graham Gooch. Good morning.
Good morning, Jonathan.
Can I quote some words at you? As you said to the team, you may not be the best players, but you can be the smartest. How much have they lived up to your words?
Well, so far, so good. I think they really battled in the first innings. Pakistan won the toss. They had the best of the bowling conditions, and it was tough to score runs. And people like Jamie Smith and Jordan Cox, adapted to the conditions. And I think that's what a lot of ex-players and pundits and everyone have asked England to do over the last few years, is not just go and play the same way every time, but adapt to what's in front of you. And, make contributions that, have an influence on the match. And certainly in that first innings, they battled hard. And yesterday morning to put on 40 runs for the last wicket was a real bonus as well, to get up to 290. So I think so far, so good. They're playing proper, strong test cricket. And, they're outplaying Pakistan is the truth of the matter.
How disappointed by Pakistan's performance? All out in less than 50 overs in all three innings so far in this series.
Yeah, I mean, they're tough conditions, the ball's moved around a little bit over here, although we've had such a wonderful summer with hot weather. The pitch here at Lord's is not a bad pitch at all. It's a good contest between bat and ball, and often a low-scoring match is a very exciting match. So technique, plays a big part. They're not flat wickets you can just hit through the line, and the Pakistan batters in particular have been found wanting with the technique. Now, when I played in Pakistan, it's a great place to play cricket. The ball swings around a bit and it turns a bit. You don't often, in my memory, get a lot of pitches that seam around off the deck. And these ones so far at Headingley and Lord's have done so. Good technique, good defensive technique, so it allows you to play your shots, later on, is a premium. And as I said, they've been found, to be lacking in technique and the skills to handle these conditions.
Talking about technique, how's Emilio Gay shaping up as an opener? That was your big position. How do you think he's doing at the moment? He's there, not out 30.
Yeah, I mean, you earn your runs on this pitch, and I've been impressed with him. Everyone needs to evolve themselves. Everyone needs to, look at things that you can improve. And certainly he's shaped up well. He gets stuck in. He's not a completely attacking opener, but he plays each ball in its merit, and he's got the shots to score. So hopefully, with a bit more experience and a bit more nous as he learns how to play test cricket, how to construct an innings and all those things, I think England got a good player for the future.
One final thought, what's the weather like where you are at Lord's? Are we going to have sunshine?
In the hotel opposite the nursery ground. And when I woke up at 6:30 this morning, it was bright sunshine. Now it's clouded over.
Right.
So that'll be good for the Pakistan bowlers. And also England will hope, I would say, that the weather... They don't want rain. Obviously, they want it to stay overcast, because I think their plan will be to bat to somewhere around tea, get 400 plus, and then put Pakistan back in. Check the forecast, obviously, for the next 2 days. I can only see one result, to be honest.
That's fine, as long as it's sunny. Thank you very much, Graham Gooch. Enjoy your day. Test match special from 10 if you can't be there. Now, what's the connection between this... and this man, Jan Choynski, one of Britain's hopes for the US Open, which starts in New York tomorrow?
They really have the mindset. Dancers' mindset is something you can look up to because they rehearse things for hours and hours and just try to get better in it. And that mindset, they passed it on to me, and that's how I look at tennis as well.
Johnny Diamond looking as if he's got the answer.
Very quizzical there. No, you can give the answers. Go on.
I'm going to give you an answer in an hour.
Ah, teasing.
So, yes, exactly. But I will tell you this. Arthur Ferry has reached his first ATP Tour final. Remember, Arthur got to the semi-finals at Wimbledon. Well, he's doing just as well. He's going to play Ignacio Buse of Peru in the final at 9 o'clock tonight at the Winston-Salem, as you knew already.
Oh, I knew that already. Right. Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. More in an hour as promised. Now, with details of this weekend's edition of Broadcasting House, here's Paddy O'Connell.
Hello. Tomorrow morning, with 200 extra police drafted in, we'll ask what explains the fear and loathing around parts of Middlesbrough. Should the UK get more bank holidays in line with other European nations? We hear a call for more women's loos at theatres, festivals and in town centres from the firm using ingenious new ways to help. We hear of a new search for the UK's favourite hymns amid fears that fewer of us are belting them out. BH is on Song tomorrow morning on BBC Sounds and here on BBC Radio 4.
Thanks, Paddy. It's 27 minutes to 8. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Henry Zeffman. And now a summary of the news from Chris Aldridge.
Rescue teams in Nepal say renewed rainfall is hampering attempts to reach some of the worst affected areas after Wednesday's catastrophic floods. The country's appeal for specialised foreign help to rescue people trapped in tunnels and to identify bodies. At least 626 people are now known to have died and 2,400 are missing. The UK is sending a specially trained crisis response team to Nepal to help support British nationals affected by the disaster. A 41-year-old man has died after a large sign fell over at a Christian festival in West Sussex. Six other people were taken to hospital with injuries. Organisers have cancelled the Big Church festival, which was due to run until tomorrow. President Trump says he signed a historic deal with Venezuela that gives the US majority control of more than 65 billion barrels of oil. He'd vowed to tap Venezuela's large reserves after the US captured its then president Nicolas Maduro in January. Venezuela's interim president, Delcy Rodriguez, said the agreement would help her nation's economic revival. More than 30 families have written to the government saying all forms of manslaughter should be excluded from the early release scheme introduced to ease prison overcrowding in England and Wales. The letter's been signed by the mother of Barnaby Webber, who was killed in the Nottingham attacks, and Diana Parks, whose daughter Joanna Simpson was killed by her estranged husband in 2010. The government says it's fast-tracking a plan to keep the most dangerous offenders behind bars. The British right-wing commentator Milo Yiannopoulos has been detained by United States immigration authorities for allegedly overstaying his visa. Officials said he was arrested at New Orleans airport and that he would be deported. Mr. Yiannopoulos has previously spoken in favour of President Trump's immigration policies. Voters in Iceland go to the polls today in a referendum on whether to reopen talks on joining the European Union, 13 years after they were broken off. Icelanders are split down the middle, although a recent poll suggested a narrow majority against restarting negotiations.
Thanks very much, Chris. It's 25 minutes to 8. The apparent use of illegal electroshock weapons by guards outside the Chinese embassy in London has prompted the Conservative Shadow National Security Minister, Alicia Kearns, to write to the Home Secretary. Footage first reported in the I newspaper appears to show embassy workers waving what looked like the weapons at protesters as they approach the gates. We asked the embassy for comment. They did not respond. Alicia Kearns, MP, is a long-time critic of the Chinese government and is the Shadow National Security Minister. She joins us. Good morning.
Good morning.
What are the main questions that you've got for the Home Secretary?
Well, first, did the Home Office authorise possession of these electroshock weapons? Because that's the fundamental. And if they haven't, how did these weapons enter the UK or were they acquired? It's now 8 weeks since this incident happened. And it seems very surprising that there appears to be no action at all since that time. And the government seems to be hiding behind this concept that it's not them that need to take action, but instead the Metropolitan Police, which is a fundamental misunderstanding of the situation when dealing with foreign embassies.
Have you heard anything back from the Home Office?
No, although to be credit to them, I did only send it yesterday, so I do give them some time. But I think that, you know, have they hauled in the ambassador to answer questions? It doesn't look like it. Have they sought a waiver of diplomatic immunity so they can deal with the individuals who are granting them? Have they considered whether this means that China should go on the foreign interference registration scheme up a tier? There are serious questions that are brought because these weapons are prohibited. And it's fascinating on social media. Lots of people keep saying to me, oh, it's a Chinese embassy. They can do whatever they want on it. That is not the case. Under the Vienna Convention, the Chinese government cannot bring in whatever they want. They still have to observe British laws, and they cannot abuse diplomatic bags or the personal baggage of diplomatic agents to bring in prohibited weapons. If they do so, and if they have them on the Chinese embassy, that is breaking multiple international and UK laws.
The government has given permission for what's been called a mega embassy on the site, I think, of the old Royal Mint in London. How do you think this alleged breach of the law plays into that?
I think it just brings up more questions for us as to if we already have a Chinese embassy potentially operating where they are bringing into the UK illegal weapons, what else do they have on the Chinese embassy site at the moment? Why would we be greenlighting an organisation who here is threatening peaceful protesters? Let's remember this was a vigil for a Tibetan protester who died. And this, unfortunately, is not without precedent. In 2022, a peaceful protester was dragged into the Chinese consulate in Manchester and assaulted, and the Chinese authorities refused to waive immunity so those people could be prosecuted. We are seeing a repeat pattern. And the reality is, if you let something like this go, you know, the procuring of illegal weapons and the threatening of people on British soil, what message does that send to the Chinese Communist Party to deter them from future hostilities? But that's why ministers need to stop hiding behind the idea that this is for the Metropolitan Police to investigate. They do not have the authority to investigate the individuals unless the Chinese embassy waives that immunity for those staff. So therefore, we have a real question, which is, why are ministers not acting and why are they hiding behind a process that they know is a dead end?
You want to see a toughening of policy towards China. You called for it for a long time. At the same time, you know, dealing with China on all kinds of different things, whether it's trade or climate change or all the rest of it, is an absolute imperative. It isn't a simple balance to strike, is it?
No, none of this is easy. But what I say is look to the Chinese Communist Party approach. They are very transactional. So we need to have an approach where we say to them, we will operate with you on climate change. We will operate with you on trade in the following areas. However, we will not import things where we are essentially, where they have weaponized supply chains and where they could have kill switches over critical national infrastructure. We will not operate with you where you do things on British soil. And fundamentally, this is about deterrence. If you are willing to let slide the smuggling of illegal weapons into our country and the threatening of peaceful protesters, and you just let it slide, that says the Chinese Communist Party, not only are they weak abroad and we can continue to do whatever we want that might threaten their security, but actually at home, they're not even willing to deter on sovereign soil. And so that's why when there are these sorts of activities, you have to be absolutely fundamental in responding. There has to be action and response, or you have no deterrence, and that means no national security.
Alicia Kearns, thank you very much.
20 to 8, and on Thursday we'll be kicking off Norman Day on Radio 4, broadcasting from the British Museum with a special programme marking the return of the Beyer Tapestry to British soil and its unveiling. It's the first time the tapestry has been in the UK in almost 1,000 years. Well, ahead of the big day, we wanted to ask some familiar voices on today for their reflections on the tapestry, 1066, and the most famous battle in British history. Here's the great historian Sir Simon Sharma, who first learnt about the tapestry at school, giving us his thoughts.
There's nothing like the Beyer Tapestry to give you this kind of thundering, powerful, scary, heroic sense of what a battle is like. Much as I store that in my little kid's memory bank, actually seeing the thing, as it were, live in Beyer just was a completely different experience. as an historian, you work with text, you work with words coming on the page. When you actually go to a place, I remember actually a great mentor of mine talked about the archive of the feet, by which he meant actually going to a particular location where something happened, even if that place is sort of empty. You do feel this kind of visceral human, physical, material connection. It's like going through a sort of magical attic belonging to a remote ancestor. There's nothing to be the immediacy of touch or look. And, you know, suddenly time just simply telescopes away and you're there. I mean, it sounds all very breathless and naive, but hey, that's me. But I think it's actually true of all real deep enthusiasts of history as well, be they teachers or consumers of history.
Sir Simon Sharma there, previewing Norman Day.
Norman Day. See what you did there.
Thursday.
Classy. Well away from the agonising debate over the future of the BBC and the news it provides is an equally agonising and arguably more urgent debate about local news. The past two decades has seen almost 300 local papers shut, reckons the UK Press Gazette. And whilst digital sites have sprung up, the closure has led to dozens of news deserts, places where there is simply no coverage of the doings of local councils, sports clubs, shops, leisure services. A challenge, perhaps, as the government carries through on its intention to devolve power down to local government. To discuss it, we're joined by Henry Fore Walker, the CEO of NewsQuest, which runs more than 150 local papers, and Dorothy Stein, the editor of The Salamander, a local news site that covers the London borough of Lewisham, which had no dedicated coverage until she set up Salamander. Good morning to you both. Henry, can I start with you? I mean, the word deployed is crisis. Is that fair?
No, I don't think it's fair. I mean, obviously, local newsrooms are certainly smaller than they were 20 years ago, and no one's pretending that it's an easy business. And there are clearly some parts of the country where journalism coverage is too thin, as you cite. But I think generally it's a lot more robust situation than people give credit for. And certainly from our perspective at NewsQuest, our local journalism is very much alive and kicking. Our journalists publish about 60,000 local stories a month. We report every day on councils and what's going on in the courts and the planning committees and public services and the like. And that journalism reaches a huge amount of people across the UK still. We online reach about 25 million people a month. And we're actually expanding whilst others might be retrenching. We're expanding. We recently launched a new local news site in London called London Now, where we think there's an opportunity there. Only last month, we launched a new local news site in Birmingham, and we're also launching new sites in smaller locations. We've just launched some hyperlocal sites in Scotland, in Motherwell and East Kilbride. So definitely more that we can do, and we do need policymakers to ensure that there is a healthy news ecosystem in the UK, because it's a really important part of our local democracy. But we feel pretty positive about the future at NewsQuest.
Dorothy, I mean, is that confidence, that optimism reflected on the ground where you are in Lewisham?
No, well, obviously, we're seeing things from a very different perspective. Yeah. We're at the other end of the scale. And for us, there are huge financial challenges. We're running on a shoestring. We depend on a team of volunteers. And, you know, while the council and the other public sector, private sector organisations that we're trying to hold to account have well-funded comms teams, and they now also produce a stream of posts on social media, it's just a hugely unbalanced situation and a real challenge for us.
Where does the money come from for you to run the things that you actually need to pay for? Even if it's volunteers, you've still got costs.
We're a co-op non-profit, but we began with really member subscribers who support us and some donations.
And what is the aim of Salamander? I mean, is it about sort of a straight line of accountability, about saying this is what the council is up to? Is it about building a sense of community?
It's both. So, we have a mission, which is public sector, ethical, public interest, community news for the benefit of the people of Lewisham, that we won't have a paywall on principle, that we should be free to read. And then we have a social justice and climate justice perspective on that. But yeah, our primary role is holding the council to account and other powerful institutions. And we also try to do investigations. Now, all of these things are very expensive.
Henry, can we talk about the BBC, which I know sounds like a rather bizarre thing to do, but you know, it has the Local Democracy Reporting Service, which has supported a lot of local news over the recent years. At the same time, there are fairly considerable complaints, aren't there, from organisations like yours about its so-called hyper-local reporting. What's the balance there?
Yeah, I think it is a two-sided coin. I mean, if you spoke to my editors, they would complain quite bitterly about how they spend a lot of time, not dissimilar to Dorothy, it's expensive doing local news. Yeah. And then we find we publish that online and then that gets ripped off pretty quickly onto the BBC website. So we feel we do a lot of the hard yards there. But I think there is a much more positive partnership going on with the BBC, which you say is this thing called the Local Democracy Reporting Service that started about 9 years ago. And that's available to all publishers, large and small, so NewsQuest and publishers like sites like Dorothy's. And that currently seeds or beds about 165 local democracy reporters. They're paid for by the BBC, but they sit and are employed by local publishers, large and small. And their specific brief is a really good one. It's to cover local councils and local public institutions. And I think, taking into account the stress that Dorothy alludes to in the sector, I think it would be a really good thing if, with the forthcoming BBC Charter review, the BBC or the government put pressure on the BBC to expand that scheme to over 300 local democracy reporters. It's difficult to cover all of the country, obviously, with 165. And I think that would be a really positive thing. It would put a bit more vitality into local public interest reporting. It would fit very closely with the BBC's public service remit, and I think it would be a healthy, as I say, a healthy boost for the sector.
Okay, we will leave it there. Henry, Dorothy, thank you very much for joining us.
It's 11 minutes to 8, and in a few minutes we'll look at whether turning high streets into housing is the way to save them. But first, it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is the Reverend Canon Dr. Rob Marshall, Rector of Digswell in Welwyn Garden City.
Good morning. I always think that this final weekend before the start of September has a kind of New Year's Eve feel about it. Indeed, looking out of my study window at the parched grass, trying to absorb the torrential rain this week, I imagine a lot of people were also thinking about returning to work or school, or simply getting back into the usual rhythm of things after the long and, for many of us, hot summer. The French call it la rentrée, meaning literally a re-entry or a coming back. And it's much bigger across the channel than our relatively tame supermarket back-to-school campaigns. There's radio jingles, adverts and shop displays heralding its arrival, not just in schools and colleges, but across most media platforms and in commerce and public life. It represents a stepping up of the pace again and a return to what might be called normality. Of course, for pupils, parents and teachers, the next few days will be a mixture of hope and apprehension, and a special thought and prayer for those starting school for the first time or beginning at a new school. It's a momentous moment. For the majority, though, the return to school is not a completely blank page. Rather, it's an opportunity to build on or improve everything that's gone before. The Christian faith has always taken new beginnings seriously. In Revelation, the final book of the Bible, God says, "Behold, I make all things new." Note that God is not saying here that everything always has to start from scratch, but that everything already underway is to be renewed and refreshed. And it's an idea we find throughout the teaching of Jesus, which overall is an invitation to begin again and to see even familiar things with something of a child's openness. Jesus describes it as new birth, like new wine needing new containers, suggesting that the new cannot always be contained by the old. A return, then, need not be going backwards, but an opportunity to see afresh what's already there. Perhaps most of us know that instinctively. We rarely get the chance to start life over again, but we are given opportunities to begin again from where we are. In the days ahead, most of us won't have a new classroom, timetable or textbook to grapple with, but perhaps the approach of September offers everyone something of a new beginning. We carry the past with us, but we need not be bound by it. And perhaps that is the real promise of every return, the chance, whatever our age, to begin again.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Canon Dr. Rob Marshall, Rector of Diggswell, Welwyn Garden City. It's 8 minutes to eight.
How to save the high street? It's a question that successive governments have tried, and in the eyes of many, failed to answer. But few have made the issue as central to their agenda as Andy Burnham, who within days of taking office vowed to improve high streets which have been, he said, hollowed out and become unrecognisable over decades of decline. But do we need to throw out our old idea of the high street if we are to save it? That's the suggestion of Sir Stuart Lipton, one of our most successful property developers, responsible for projects like Broadgate and the 22 Bishopsgate skyscraper in London. And Sir Stuart Lipton joins us now. Good morning, Sir Stuart. Let's take it as given that the high street is in crisis, and let's take it as a given that lots of us want to revive them. What would a successful high street look like to you?
Well, the high street has got to change. To be successful, it's got to have a mix of activities. It's not just shops. It's housing on the high street. It's retail, independent and specialist chains. It's services and hospitality, cafes, fitness, repair, things that make people stay rather than merely transact. A third civic: GP surgeries, libraries, nurseries, education, workspace. Look at the Men's Shed organisation where you can make things. It's got to be a place that we enjoy, that we have fun.
So essentially, you're saying we don't necessarily need to seek to recapture an old-style pre-internet high street where the vast bulk of the units are retail units.
That's all gone. We can't out-Amazon. And look at the rates they pay compared with shopkeepers in an average high street. That must be changed.
Well, on that point, because that's really interesting, because Andy Burnham has mooted, sorry to interrupt, Andy Burnham has mooted charging higher levies on the giant warehouses that are operated by online firms such as Amazon in order to fund a cut in business rates for leisure venues. And Mike Ashley, the Sports Direct founder, said this week that that was delusional. But it sounds like you disagree with Mike Ashley.
Amazon is a wonderful organisation, very convenient. But that convenience has got to return to the high street. And they'll pay a fifth of a high street retailer. So how can a small, interesting retailer with something new beat Amazon? It's impossible. So the first thing to do is make the big retailers in the high street pay a fair rate. Why not similar to Amazon? But we must think of those smaller retailers. They're the growth of the country. They're the interest we have in the high street. It's something to do, somewhere to go. The high street's a social place. It's not just shopping. We've all changed since COVID. We want to meet each other, greet each other, talk, fun. It's back in many ways to an old-style place where the village green meant something.
I mean, you see an opportunity here, even though, as I mentioned in the introduction, a lot of your career has been building huge office spaces, but you clearly see an opportunity for the high street to revive in the sort of working from home revolution.
Look, my particular love is creating places. And the problem that we have is who is going to create the place. It's not something that just happens by accident. It's got to have leadership. Who will fund the high street? Who will create it? Who will be the impresario that puts on music at night, a lecture on how to cook dinner tomorrow for £5? Be practical. How do we bring back foreigners to high streets to spend, for instance? We have a profusion of wonderful towns where foreigners used to buy, but now they don't get tax-free.
You mentioned business rates. What else could the government do to allow this vision that you envisage to come to fruition?
Well, every high street must be beautiful. it must be civilized. You must have a decent toilet, even park occasionally. But above all, it's got to be interesting. When you go down the high street, you think of some art, some tradition, some history, some future, some tech. Where do the neets go? Where do they go to learn? Where does grandma go coming out from hospital so she's not bed blocking, but she's active? She's running the cafe where you can get a cappuccino for a pound. What is it that the coffee does to us? It stimulates discussion.
Okay. Sir Stuart Lipton, I'm sure many will hear your vision and be intrigued and enthused, but for now we have to leave it there. Stuart Lipton, co-founder of Lipton Rogers Developments, appreciate you joining us.
Throughout the coming week, Radio 4 asks some searching questions about 9/11.
It was the deadliest terror attack in history. Why, 25 years on, are so many relatives of those who died still asking questions?
And they were like, did you know that they were two of the terrorists that flew their planes into the Pentagon? And I went, what?
And do the answers rest with one man accused of helping the hijackers?
Either an officer or an employee or an operative of the Saudi intelligence service.
He was a spy.
He was a spy.
A 9/11 story, presented by me, Jane McMullen, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, this Monday to Friday at 1:45.
At 2 minutes to eight, time for a look at the weather, and Stav Danaos is at the BBC Weather Centre for us this morning.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Henry and Johnny. Well, it's looking unsettled this weekend and indeed into the bank holiday Monday with low pressure systems hurtling off the Atlantic. They will bring strong winds at times for some of us. Outbreaks of rain followed by showers, which will be heavy and thundery as well. But there will be some sunshine in between. It's not going to be a complete washout throughout the weekend. Today, though, we've got a new area of low pressure working its way into the southwest quadrant of the UK. So I'll start with England and Wales. We'll see this rain across the southwest and South Wales spreading northwards and eastwards throughout the morning. Some of it will be heavy, possibly thundery as well. We'll see a lot of standing water on the roads. It will continue to push northwards and eastwards, followed by sunshine and some thundery showers into the afternoon. Winds picking up across southwest England through the channel, gusting 40-50 miles an hour. Temperatures 18 to 23 degrees, pretty much where we should be for the time of year. Scotland starts dry and bright in places with a little bit of sunshine. Cloud will tend to build, but it looks like it'll stay mostly dry today. Scotland, I think, very best with today's weather. Most of the action taking place south of the border. Temperatures 16 to 20 degrees. Northern Ireland, you'll see the cloud building up, though. One or two spots of rain and also showers will move eastwards, but even northern areas will tend to stay dry. Got 16 to 19 Celsius, but it does stay unsettled as we head into tomorrow and Monday.
Thanks, Stav. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Henry Zeffman and Johnny Diamond.
It's 8 o'clock on Saturday, the 29th of August. The headlines this morning. There's been a big rise in the number of people listed as dead or missing after the catastrophic floods in Nepal and Tibet. There are some miracles in the mud.
Matty wipes away tears as she speaks on the phone to the son that she was sure had died. 8-year-old Zoyal was on his way to school when the waters came. I had completely lost hope, she says.
But others are waiting for news. We'll hear from a young South Londoner whose parents are missing. The UK's largest Christian music festival has been cancelled after a sign collapsed, killing one person and injuring six others. And President Trump has hailed a deal which he says will hand the US control over a fifth of Venezuela's oil reserves.
Also in today's programme, more than 30 families who felt the impact of homicide call on the government to ensure all those convicted of manslaughter are kept in prison longer. We'll put that to Minister Bridget Phillipson at 20 past eight. Roald Dahl's short stories get the Netflix treatment. We'll explore the art of short-form storytelling and right to the heart of Nashville, Tennessee.
Let's give her a great big welcome right now. Pretty Miss Dolly Parton. How about it?
There's no way that girl standing on the Opry stage could have ever imagined what she was in for.
As the crown jewel of country music celebrates the life of Dolly Parton, we'll hear from the man hosting one final hurrah.
I'm Jonathan Ledyard with your Saturday Sport and the power of parents. As the final Grand Slam of the season, the US Open, starts this weekend, Britain's Jan Chojnski, who's just broken into the world top 100 for the first time, tells us how having professional ballet dancers as his parents helped his tennis.
You're more flexible, you're more aware of your body, the coordination is maybe a bit better, and that's all things that you need on the tennis court.
The BBC News is read by Chris Aldridge.
Nepal has appealed for specialised foreign help to rescue people trapped in tunnels and identify and store bodies, days after devastating flash floods tore through the north of the country. At least 616 people are now known to have died there. But officials in one district say many of the bodies they've recovered are no longer identifiable. The number listed as missing in Nepal has risen again to more than 2,400, including 33 British nationals. Rescue efforts are being hampered by poor weather, as our South Asia correspondent Azadeh Mashiri reports from Trishuli.
Rain is falling again across northern Nepal, and emergency teams are warning it's making it difficult to reach some of the worst affected areas. Wednesday's flood has swept away bridges and roads, and helicopters have been making relentless journeys back and forth to ferry survivors to safety. Thousands of people cut off from the rest of the country have been saved so far. In neighbouring India, authorities have said seven bodies have been recovered from rivers flowing from Nepal, and they are believed to be victims of the flood. Here in Trishuli, the military have been issuing warnings of more possible flooding. There are fears a glacial lake formed of floodwater and debris near the Nepal-Tibet border could breach its banks. But for now, the greatest danger has passed, leaving the country to confront the worst disaster Nepal has seen since an earthquake in 2015.
The UK is sending a specially trained crisis response team to Nepal to help support British nationals affected by the floods. The rapid deployment team will work alongside the British Embassy and local authorities to help people find information about missing relatives and liaise with rescue teams. In neighbouring Tibet, Chinese state media says the number of people killed has risen to seven, with more than 550 missing. Rescue operations there have restarted after they were paused because of fears of more flooding. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker is monitoring the situation from Beijing.
New footage from Chinese state media has revealed the scale of the destruction on the Tibetan side of the border. Rescue teams are shown wandering in a wasteland of mud and rock in what was once a bustling border crossing, calling out in the hope of finding survivors. A small team finally reached Girong Port between Nepal and Tibet yesterday afternoon after trekking over mountains, scaling cliff faces and crossing raging rivers. Rescuers told the state broadcaster that it was a scene of ruins, covered only in thick mud. Water levels in a lake which formed in the debris of the landslide are reported to be rising once again. The command team in charge of rescue efforts have launched drones and set up observation posts to monitor the slopes and provide an early warning system to rescuers working nearby.
A man has died and six people have been injured after a large sign fell in strong winds at a Christian event in West Sussex. Organisers have cancelled the big church festival, which had been due to run until tomorrow. Our correspondent Duncan Kennedy sent this report from the site near Stenning.
The festival was just getting underway when what appears to be a large blue sign came down on top of people. One eyewitness spoke of the confusion that followed among those nearby. Sussex police have confirmed that a 41-year-old man from Eastbourne has died. They say his next of kin have been informed and are being supported by specialist officers. Six people were also injured and taken to hospital. The event is the largest Christian festival in Britain and has been going since 2009. In a statement, the organisers said their thoughts and prayers were with all those impacted by the incident. Police have urged people with any information or relevant video footage to contact them.
President Trump has announced a deal with Venezuela that gives the US majority control of more than 65 billion barrels of oil, about a fifth of the country's proven reserves. Mr. Trump claimed it would lower American petrol prices and boost prosperity in Venezuela, whose president, Nicolas Maduro, he ousted in January. Venezuela's interim leader, Delcy Rodriguez, said the deal was worth more than $300 billion in investment and tax revenue for her country. Ian McWilliam reports.
Donald Trump described his new deal with Venezuela as the biggest oil deal in world history. He said it would more than double US oil reserves and substantially lower prices for US consumers. Rising domestic fuel costs have been a primary concern of the president as the November midterms approach, and Iran continues to block shipments through the Strait of Hormuz. Media reports say that in return for a US ownership stake, private companies, including American firms, would develop Venezuelan oil fields and return more oil revenue to Venezuela. The Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has said the deal would bring nearly $100 billion of private investment to Venezuela and support thousands of high-paying jobs there.
Heavy gunfire and explosions have been heard in the capital of Niger. Shooting has been reported near Niamey's International Airport, an air base, and the presidential palace. Since a military coup in 2023, the West African nation has struggled to repel jihadist groups linked to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State. Another seven men have been arrested by detectives investigating organised crime in Middlesbrough. The inquiry is linked to a crash on the A66, which killed seven people, including two police officers. In the weeks since, there's been a series of violent incidents in the town, prompting the deployment of hundreds of extra police officers. Phil McCann reports from Middlesbrough.
Cleveland Police says it's determined to pursue those intent on causing violence to communities on Teesside. It's so far arrested 24 people since the crash last Saturday. The most recent arrests include four people who are being questioned on suspicion of criminal damage with intent to endanger life and arson in relation to a fire in a caravan. Three others have been arrested on suspicion of making threats to kill. They've since been released on bail.
More than 30 families have called on the Prime Minister to stop killers convicted of any form of manslaughter being released early to ease prison overcrowding in England and Wales. The open letter has been signed by Emma Webber, whose son Barnaby was killed in the Nottingham attacks, and the BBC commentator John Hunt, whose wife and two daughters were murdered in a crossbow attack. The letter was organised by Hetty Barkworth-Nanton, who chairs the domestic abuse organisation Refuge.
I think when the conversations about early release started to come up, for everyone, whether they're included in the early release or not, it just sends a shiver through your spine and a shudder to your heart, because it brings back everything that you experienced at the beginning and continue to experience. And it's really traumatic and horrifying.
The government says it's fast-tracking a plan to keep the most dangerous offenders behind bars. Immigration officers in the US have detained the British right-wing commentator Milo Yiannopoulos, accusing him of overstaying his visa. Mr. Yiannopoulos, a former editor of the conservative website Breitbart, is now facing deportation. Here's our North America correspondent, Shaima Khalil.
U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, known as ICE, says Milo Yiannopoulos was arrested at New Orleans Airport and that he had chosen to overstay his welcome. The British citizen entered the United States legally in 2019. ICE says he failed to attend an immigration hearing and was issued with a final removal order last month. Mr. Yiannopoulos rose to prominence as a Breitbart editor and outspoken supporter of Donald Trump. He has backed the president's tougher immigration policies, although he recently said that Mr. Trump had lost his way. The self-styled provocateur has repeatedly attracted condemnation for inflammatory comments about Muslims, transgender people, feminists, and the Black Lives Matter movement.
The British boxer Moses Itauma will fight for the vacant IBF heavyweight title at the O2 Arena in London tonight. The 21-year-old faces the veteran Croatian Filip Hrgović, as Adi Adedoyan reports.
Moses Itauma is a rising star in the sport. He has an unblemished record of 14 wins with 12 knockouts and now stands on the brink of history. A win against Filip Hrgović will make him Britain's youngest heavyweight world champion and the second youngest in history behind America's Mike Tyson. But this bout is likely to be his toughest test so far. The 34-year-old Croatian is an Olympic bronze medalist and has only lost once in close to 9 years. Tempers frayed at last night's weigh-in, Itauma pushed Hrgović off stage before receiving a slap to the face from his opponent.
And that was Adi Adedoyin.
Thanks very much, Chris. There are nearly 2,000 people unaccounted for in Nepal since Wednesday's glacier collapse sent unfathomable amounts of water, ice and debris tearing through towns and villages. 626 people are now confirmed dead, say Nepal's police. That total continues to rise. On the ground, there is search and rescue. In the air, helicopters ferry the injured to hospital and bring supplies to those stranded. Around the world, relatives are trying to find out what has happened to their wives and sons, cousins and husbands, some of the more than 500 foreign nationals still missing. And all the while in Nepal, the authorities monitor the water levels as impromptu lakes created by the debris threaten yet more disaster. Our World Affairs correspondent Joe Inwood has been drawing together stories from across Nepal.
This is the sound of the flooding 3 days on. As she lies in a doorway, dressed in bright yellow robes, we do not know what has caused this woman such pain. But whole communities were wiped out in an instant. Stories like that of Gyambat Sering, who looks lost as he speaks, are everywhere. My wife and son were taken by the flood, he says. My whole village was taken by the flood. Almost all the roads were swept away. All the bridges are gone. And that is why getting help to the affected areas has been so difficult. With roads destroyed, most villages are only accessible from above. But Nepal is a poor country, and its resources are limited, as are helicopters. Search and rescue teams are doing what they can and still saving lives. Four figures emerge from a tunnel on the mountainside. They are all caked in thick mud. Bright yellow hard hats are the only thing that distinguishes the rescuers from the rescued. Another man is pulled from the tunnel, this time on his stomach. In total, it's thought 100 men, all workers at a new hydroelectric dam, which is now destroyed, were rescued from these tunnels. But operations like this are not without risk. Two police officers on the back of a motorbike warn people that another flood could be coming. Stay away from the river, they say. There are fears that a huge new lake has formed high up in the mountains and that it could burst at any time. For now, Chinese rescue teams say the risk is manageable, but it is still a risk. International aid is starting to get through. At a camp, World Health Organization supplies are piled up. Alongside medical equipment, there are body bags. Huge pallets of supplies are unloaded, but this is just the start of what will be needed. The Red Cross estimates nearly 100,000 people have been affected by what was essentially a tsunami roaring down a mountain valley. One of them is Chandra. He knows that his ordeal has only just begun. I am old and my life is already half behind me, he says. But surviving is itself a great thing, and I am grateful to have seen so much in my life and to see my relatives safe. Looking at our situation now, I hope our government will do something important for us, to give us shelter to live. But amidst all the desperation, there are miraculous stories of survival. Matty wipes away tears as she speaks on the phone to the son that she was sure had died. 8-year-old Zoyal was on his way to school when the waters came. I had completely lost hope, she says, as tears roll down her face. I thought I no longer had my children, and I thought that there was no point in staying alive. But Zoyal managed to escape, climbing up a tree. Somehow, with a broken leg, he survived. As she sits by his hospital bedside, the family reunited. He eventually falls asleep.
Joe Inwood reporting there. Well, I mentioned that around 500 foreign nationals are missing, more than 30 of those from Britain, and 16 of those are from the South London Sanatan Mandir temple and community. Prajwal Haldia joins us. He's still waiting for word from his parents who are part of that community. Good morning, Prajwal.
Morning.
Have you had anything from your parents?
No further news yet from any authorities or any other sources.
May I ask when you last heard from them?
So I spoke to them on Tuesday during the day on the phone, and obviously connection in the mountain is anyway a bit dodgy. And I had a message early Wednesday morning around 2 a.m., which is like maybe just about an hour before the flood is supposed to have hit.
I mean, it must be a very, very difficult time for you. What kind of support are you getting?
I mean, the relevant authorities are obviously in touch every day. So the Foreign Office is, I think, doing a good job being in touch all they can. And they also have limited information. So just keeping us updated is always a good start. And then we've got the community around us, and all family and friends are obviously very supportive at the moment.
I mean, I know that some people who are trying to hear from relatives have been talking about, you know, trying to get on a flight or trying to get to Kathmandu. Have you thought about that? Is that something that you want to do? Or?
Yeah, I mean, the first instinct was obviously to try and get out there and help in any way I can. But, like, if you take a step back, I think it's going there doesn't help in any way. Like, we're not rescuers, we're not trained to do that. There's people that I think we just get in the way, to be honest. So I think for now we should let the people and officials do their jobs and try and save as many lives as possible, and then maybe consider going out there.
I mentioned that more than a dozen people from the Sanatan Mandir temple were missing. I mean, the whole community must be struggling with this.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult time for everyone, because a lot of the people there were obviously regular attendees of that Mandir, and also other like communities around London. So yeah, it's a difficult time for everyone, I think.
And when it comes to trying to get in touch, I mean, presumably you are phoning, but what, just getting nothing at the moment?
Yeah, it just goes. Like, it's like their phones switched off, right? The ring doesn't even go through, so.
It must be, I mean, it must be particularly difficult just not knowing, not having any clue of what is going on at the moment.
Yeah, I think obviously we're following the news as much as we can. That's the main source of information at the moment. Yeah. And I just, like, urge all the authorities to work together as much as they can, because obviously it's spread out across the Chinese authorities, then the police authorities and the British. So just urge them to work together to try and get us information as soon as possible.
Yeah. You don't have brothers or sisters, but I mean, again, presumably you are in touch constantly with other members of the community and getting support and help from them.
Yeah, everyone's been extremely, extremely kind and supportive given the circumstances. So I think I have about 2 weeks worth of food in the freezer already from everyone. But yeah.
Prajwal, we'll leave it there. Thank you very, very much for sharing your time and your experience with us. And we, and I'm sure all the people listening today, wish you the very best of luck going into the future. Thank you.
It's 19 minutes past eight. For those at the Reading and Leeds festivals this weekend, on the bill, Charlie XCX, Fontaines DC, Florence and the Machine, and a government campaign combating violence against women and girls. Government messaging is being displayed around the festivals, raising awareness of abusive behaviours that often go unrecognised in the hope of shifting attitudes among younger people. But the government's commitment to protecting women from violence is being questioned this morning by those concerned about plans to free hundreds of prisoners earlier than they otherwise would be. More than 30 families affected by some of the country's high-profile murders have asked the Prime Minister not to free anyone convicted of any type of manslaughter. One of those who's written to the government is Hetty Barkworth Nanton, whose best friend was killed by her ex-husband.
For everyone, whether they're included in the early release or not, it just sends a shiver through your spine and a shudder to your heart, because it brings back everything that you experienced at the beginning and continue to experience. And it's really traumatic and horrifying. So I think that's why you've got on this letter some, you know, a lot of people who are not affected by early release, but they know how important it is to get these things right and to treat victims in the right and fair way.
Well, I'm delighted to say that Bridget Phillipson, the Minister for Women and Equalities, as well as the Chair of the Labour Party, joins us in the studio this morning. Bridget Phillipson, we'll return to your announcement, but if we could just start on that letter. Its signatories say they feel victims are being asked to bear the consequences of the prison capacity crisis. I mean, that is simply true, isn't it?
Look, I really have the utmost respect and sympathy for the victims and their families, who will, I appreciate, be finding all of this discussion deeply unsettling. I appreciate the impact it has. We have faced some really difficult and unpalatable choices because of the huge crisis that was left behind in the prisons estate. The Justice Secretary will be setting out the position to Parliament next week, so full details will be provided in terms of the approach. But we have been clear that the most serious offenders will be exempt from that early release programme. But the reality of what we are confronting is that if allowed to go unchecked, we could end up in a position where someone who was arrested for very serious offences, for example, offences related to violence against a woman, and we wouldn't have anywhere to send that individual. That was the full kind of scale of the real crisis we face. And of course, the Tories knew this. They knew this at the point at which they called the election, because they weren't prepared to front up to the challenges, and they didn't create enough prison capacity in the years that they were in government so that we don't have to be even considering these kinds of options, which in an ideal world, we would not be having to consider.
And the signatories to this letter do acknowledge that implicitly when they talk in that quote that I read you about the prison capacity crisis. But they are questioning whether you have found the right people to bear the consequences of this. Are you satisfied that there really is no other way?
The full detail of what's to be announced will be set out in Parliament, and I can't preempt that. But we are clear that the most serious offenders will not be subject to this programme.
Manslaughter is pretty serious. It always involves someone dying. And yet we don't believe that every case of manslaughter will be exempted. That's one of the things they're questioning in this letter.
No, I understand, and I can't get ahead of that announcement. But Andy Burnham was clear that over the summer he wanted the Justice Secretary to look again at those who would or would not be eligible for early release. But I do genuinely really understand how difficult this is. We've seen some appalling cases, including that of those individuals convicted of involvement in the murder of PC Harper, for example, where they quite rightly have also been calling for action in that area, something that the Prime Minister has taken seriously and that the Justice Secretary has been considering in recent weeks.
Well, on that specific example, because it was the case of PC Andrew Harper, which so many members of the public will remember from the time and are so horrified by, that prompted the Prime Minister to ask Alex Norris, the Justice Secretary, to have another look at this. And that's what Alex Norris is going to be talking about on Tuesday in the House of Commons. There's an allusion to that in this letter. The signatories say the protection now being considered for one group of bereaved families should not inadvertently exclude others whose loved ones were killed. That's presumably a reference to the Andrew Harper case. Do you have any worries about making decisions based on which cases, for horrific and understandable reasons, capture the public's interest and then leaving to one side, perhaps inadvertently, cases which members of the public aren't aware of?
Being completely frank, I think we have lots of concerns. I have lots of concerns. We as a government have lots of concerns about some of the choices that we're being confronted with. But that's the world in which politics is. You know, we have to confront these difficult challenges that we face. We can't dodge them or seek to hide from them. And the reason that we're in this mess in the first place is because for years and years, the previous government didn't front up to what was needed, didn't create prison capacity, sent more people to prison, but didn't make sure that we had the places available. And we were facing the wholesale collapse of the criminal justice system. I can't stress more strongly than that, that we could have ended up with someone being arrested for a very serious offence and nowhere to send them.
We'll move on to your announcement now, which is clearly an unusual and unconventional place to hold a government campaign, music festivals. Is this because you think there's a specific problem with young people?
We have seen a growth in abusive behaviour in teenage relationships, and it's an area that's often not as well understood, because people, when they think about violence against women and girls, will think about often adult relationships in the context of domestic violence and sexual violence. But we know that this is a growing challenge around our young people. The misogyny and abuse, that the kind of the material that they will see online, that is really fueling some of these harmful attitudes. And, you know, tackling violence against women and girls is one of the defining challenges of our age. It's something that this government takes extremely seriously. It's something that I'm personally committed to, having worked in this area before I became a Member of Parliament. And I think we've got a fantastic opportunity at Leeds and Reading Festival this weekend to make the positive case for change amongst young people, to also demonstrate the help that's available, but also to tackle some of those attitudes. I want young women who are going to Leeds and Reading this weekend to have a brilliant time, not worried about their personal safety, able to have able to live their lives as freely as possible. And that's why tackling those attitudes, providing the right support, is absolutely critical. And this is a great way to reach that audience.
Can I just finally ask you, you represent a constituency in Sunderland. It's not that far from Middlesbrough. And the Cleveland Police and Crime Commissioner, Matt Storey, he's a Labour politician, told Newsnight last night, we need better resources, more police on the ground. We're still 200 officers short of where we were in 2010, when austerity, of course, under the Conservative governments, kicked in. We need to be properly resourced. Are you satisfied that in response to the situation in Middlesbrough, that the government has given them the resource they need?
So in the short term, there has been extra resource, both in terms of officers, mutual aid and support given, and we'll continue to look at what's needed, because what has happened in Middlesbrough, it is shocking, and the police are doing a tremendous job in very challenging circumstances. Cleveland Police are getting more money, but there is a need to continue to look at that funding settlement in terms of the review, the formula review. I represent an area that borders Cleveland, which just almost borders it. And we face similar challenges in Northumbria. We saw over the course of more than a decade, resources pulled away from communities in terms of policing resource, like the Northumbria Force area, like Cleveland. And that has had really big challenges.
Similar challenges with organised crime in your area as well?
We face similar challenges around organised crime, around antisocial behaviour, around gang activity, absolutely. Much of which will be connected across the whole of the region. The Northeast isn't a big place. And I know that this will be a really worrying time for lots of families across Middlesbrough. The police are taking action. Lots of arrests that we just heard on the news bulletin that are taking place, and I'm sure they'll continue to take the action that's needed. But lots of people in communities like mine and places like Middlesbrough over many years saw effectively a breakdown in law and order in their communities because of the lack of a police presence. We're putting that right. We're putting back neighbourhood policing into those communities. But I do recognise that in the short term, Cleveland need to continue to receive that support to deal with what they're facing.
Bridget Phillipson, Minister for Women and Equalities. Really appreciate you joining us this morning.
We'll be picking up on that conversation that Henry and Bridget Phillipson were having at 8:30 when we speak to the Mayor of Middlesbrough, talk to him about the resources that he has, that his police have, and what is driving the disorder. That's at 8:30. Now we'll have the sport with Jonathan.
A weather forecast from the former England cricket captain Graham Gooch on the programme an hour ago was not encouraging for the third day of the second test at Lord's. Basically rain. It's not raining in London just yet. England due to resume their second innings at 81 for three. A lead of 261 over Pakistan are all out for just 110 in their first innings. Cricket commentary and conversation, of course, on TMS, Test Match Special from 10 this morning on BBC Sounds. Now, with the US Open tennis starting tomorrow, Britain's Wimbledon semi-finalist Arthur Ferrier is shaping up nicely. He's reached his first ATP Tour final overnight in North Carolina, and he'll play Ignacio Bousset of Peru for the title this evening. Meanwhile, in New York, another British player, Jan Choinski, is looking to maintain the form which has taken him into the world's top 100 for the first time. His ranking of 77 earned him automatic qualification at Wimbledon and the US Open. He's now 30, the son of parents whose careers as professional ballet dancers have been a significant influence on his career. Instead of a plié or an arabesque, he needs his serve and volleys to carry him as deep into the tournament as possible. And he's been telling me he's determined to make the most of these newfound opportunities.
It's not easy to reach the top 100 without any confidence, so I wouldn't say I wasn't confident before, but having made that next step, I believe that on a good day, I'm dangerous to any player. I'm just focusing on the things that I can influence, and I think once I do that, I'm a dangerous opponent to anyone.
You've gone through a lot of hip surgery, you went through COVID, you've had back injuries, you dropped out of the top 600 a few years ago. What is it that's brought you back to this level in particular? You talked a lot about hard work, but what in particular have you focused on which has got you to this high level?
All my career at the start, up until a year before COVID maybe, I was like pretty much injury free. So I was able to play a lot of tournaments year by year. And then sadly, you know, when I was like climbing the rankings, I think up to like 250 or something, I got a hip issue, and I knew at that early stage of my career, you know, it wouldn't be the best to have it unsolved, the problem, and just continue playing like that. So I decided to have arthroscopic hip surgery. After that, it was a long way to get back to my old form and also even being able to step out on court. And then during COVID, I played a couple of exhibitions, Battle of the Brits and all of those, and I got a shoulder problem. So that took a while as well. Ended up in a little surgery. So basically, I was out for like 2 years. I'm thankful to the LTA because at that time I was practicing and living at the National Tennis Centre in London. That's then after that when I really made a significant jump in the rankings. My main goal was to get healthy, get back, and then just see how far I can take it.
How much does mindset or mentality complement or even add another few layers to improve fitness in your rise?
Mindset is everything, I think, in the sport. You know, even more important than talent, for sure, there's more gifted players than others in terms of their feeling, you know, for the ball and everything. But if you don't work hard and you're not willing, you know, to basically sacrifice and put in the hours, then it's very difficult to achieve anything in tennis. So I think I'm gifted with a very good mindset. I like working hard. My parents always taught me, you know, to give it my all, and that's what I do.
You've always praised your family, particularly your parents, two professional ballet dancers, your father Polish, your mother British. I wonder how much their example of dedication, their knowledge of commitment and the highs and lows of such a high-profile performance, how much that helped you understand what you needed to do if you were going to succeed in tennis?
That's a significant thing in my upbringing, their background. And they've always been extremely, extremely hard workers, be it in ballet or afterwards in their ballet school. They really have the mindset. Dancers' mindset is something you can look up to because they rehearse things for hours and hours and just try to get better in it. And that mindset, they passed it on to me. And that's how I look at tennis as well, you know, and to make it better and make it work.
They passed that on. What about ballet? Are you good at ballet? What are your ballet skills like? Did you ever try it?
I did up until I was 12, I think. I was dancing quite a lot. But then we always knew that tennis is my main focus. So like I was just doing that basically, you know, to improve in my general development of like coordination and stuff. But I think for my height, because I'm quite tall, it helped a lot. That just benefits, you know, like you're more flexible, you're more aware of your body, the coordination is maybe a bit better. And yeah, that's all things that you need on the tennis court.
Jan, thank you very much indeed for talking to us on the Today programme.
Thank you.
Any good at ballet, Johnny?
I am very good at ballet, actually. I'm a little disappointed that we haven't had a reprise of the Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy, which we had at 7:30.
Go ahead.
I'll be showing my legs to the assembled team here. They're blanching at the prospect. Thank you very much, Johnny.
Exactly. Yeah, first match on Tuesday, by the way. Full coverage, 5 Live. Russell Fuller and the team from Flushing Meadows. And also look out for the British boxer Moses Itama fighting for the vacant IBF heavyweight title at the O2 Arena in London tonight. Coverage on 5 Live.
I thank you again, Jonathan.
What has the BBC ever done to open our eyes to the world?
Well, it's taken a deep dive into the world of AI.
I don't think anyone really understood what would happen when hundreds of millions of people started using this new technology.
Shared strong opinions from across the country.
Welcome to Question Time. Our audience reflects the general political picture across the nation.
And asked even more difficult questions with Louis Theroux.
You know, because there's a lot of toll that comes with being in the public eye. Do you keep an eye on that?
There's a BBC for each of us, funded by all of us. This is our BBC.
Now the time is 26 minutes to 9. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Henry Zeffman. And with a summary of the news, Chris Aldridge.
Officials in Nepal say the number of people known to have died in the devastating floods and landslides has risen to 626. More than 2,400 people are missing. Chinese video footage from Tibet's border with Nepal shows the scale of destruction, with rescue teams seen struggling through a wasteland of mud and rock. A 41-year-old man has died after a large sign fell over at a Christian outdoor music festival in West Sussex. Six other people were taken to hospital with injuries. The big church festival has been cancelled, with organisers saying they're devastated by the incident. President Trump says he's reached a huge oil deal with Venezuela, whose president, Nicolas Maduro, he ousted in January. Mr. Trump said the US would gain control over a fifth of Venezuela's oil reserves, which would bring down petrol prices in the US. A migrant has died attempting to cross the Channel from France to the UK in a dinghy carrying 110 people. The French authorities said he'd suffered a cardiac arrest. Three other people were injured.
Thanks very much, Chris. It's been a week in a very hard spotlight for the town of Middlesbrough in North Yorkshire. 7 days ago, a crash that killed two police constables and five young men. So-called ram raiding on two properties. What's alleged to have been the firebombing of another property and disorder at what were thought to be vigils for some of the young men killed in the car crash. All the time, drip, drip, drip reports of lawlessness, drug dealing and gang violence that's made life a misery for the majority of residents. I'm joined by Chris Cook, the Mayor of Middlesbrough. Chris, thank you very much for joining us this morning. I said it was a week in a hard spotlight. How has it been for you? How has it been for the town?
It's tough, obviously, as these things naturally are. I think it is one of those things that Middlesbrough, sadly, has and we are not immune to by any stretch of the imagination. But I think one of the key things is actually we always bounce back, we're always persistent, we're always here. But I think overall, one of the things that even police were feeding back to me as of yesterday was they are overwhelmed by the kindness of people. They are stowed out, I think is probably the right word, at all of the police stations with offers of food and help. And I think they've seen the best of people come forward through what has been quite a really tough week.
I understand there's been a very strong community response. At the same time, there is no denying a background level of lawlessness. Yesterday on Radio 4, a local MP, Anna Turley, talked about levels of deprivation, about cuts to police, about cuts to local authorities. Your predecessor, Andy Preston, seemed to give a slightly different story of essentially criminals being able to get away with it, of being unarrestable and untouchable. What lies at the heart of the problems of lawlessness in Middlesbrough?
So I find that rather ironic, given how many arrests have already been made.
Yeah,
police are doing an absolutely sterling job to round up as many people as possible and make those arrests. When I first came in 2027, the amount of crimes in that year was 27,000, which had risen over 35% over the last 4 years. We've seen reductions for the last 2 years. This year is almost guaranteed that we won't see a reduction. But there's a trajectory there that we that police were making progress. They are the second most improved police force in the UK. They are doing extremely well, despite and in spite of the lack of funding that they absolutely need. They are a police force that has been the hardest hit. They have had over a 10% reduction in FTE of police officers, while other places have seen over a 20% increase. And that isn't fair. The funding for police needs to follow need and needs to follow what the statistics are. It cannot just be based on population size as it currently is, because that serves no one well. It needs to be based on need. And I think for me, it's about the long-term effects, and it's about the things that we do to stop the statistics happening. But by the time a crime shows up on the crime statistics, it's already too late by that point. So that's why my focus at the minute is about youth clubs. There'll be a youth club in every single ward, but it's also about making sure that we have opportunities for young people. So we've got the 10 by 10 program, which is to ensure that every child by the age of 10 gets 10 aspirational opportunities, to make sure that they can see that there are other paths in life. Those are the sort of things which won't stop criminals today, tomorrow, but it's about breaking those cycles which are just going to go on and go on and go on.
You speak of community spirit. You speak of community spirit. You speak of the ambitions that you have. You clearly think there are great possibilities in Middlesbrough, that you have reasons for optimism, despite some of the reports coming back about the challenges that there are, about some people frankly having just given up.
And I would think that I would sort of reflect on the fact that I've lived here and in Teesside all of my life, majority in Middlesbrough. I grew up in the care system. I was in foster care. I've been in some of the estates and lived in some of the estates and witnessed some of the things myself as I was growing up. I know probably better than some of the people who claim to speak on these sorts of subjects, who have never lived in those sorts of world, never lived in the estates, and come from a place of not really understanding what's driving some of those issues. Those estates aren't written off. Those estates aren't forgotten or left behind. We just haven't managed to get them to the place they need to be yet. And a lot of that comes down to how much are we willing to accept a narrative that we are a place that is lawlessness, which is just not the case because police are arresting. Mm. Are we just willing to accept that as our future? Are we willing to actually focus on a better tomorrow for not only us, but our children and our future generations? And if that isn't the focus, then we might as well all give up. But for me, that will never, I'll never have that. I will always have the resolve that we need to make sure that we go forward, we do the best that we can, and we uplift every single generation so it's better than the one that came before it. Okay. And I think if it'll be so easy to lose sight of that in the midst of what's happening. But okay. Today we have Pride. Tomorrow we have a 5K and a 10K run in the town centre. Those things
will have. Yeah, Chris, I'm really sorry. Thank you very much for joining us. We do have to leave it there, but thank you for joining us there. Chris Cook, Mayor of Middlesbrough.
18 minutes to nine, and the new Chancellor, John Healey, will travel to his first G20 meeting of finance ministers this weekend. But once he's back from the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, beautiful part of the world, questions about the shape of his first budget, which is due in just under 2 months, and what his choices on tax and spend say about the shape of Andy Burnham's government will dominate Westminster. Already this week, there's been a hint at tax rises and reports that the defence spending targets demanded by the former Defence Secretary, John Healey, may not be met. Well, to discuss the challenges facing the Chancellor as he seeks growth and a way to improve Labour's political fortunes while he's at it, we have Mariana Mazzucato, professor at UCL and author of The Common Good Economy, and Matt Pound, former political director to Rachel Reeves until March. Thank you very much both for joining us. Let's start with you, Mariana. Jim O'Neill, sometime advisor to Andy Burnham on the economy. We're told that Andy Burnham tried to attract him to a role in his government. He's been warning in the Times this morning, as he did similarly on this programme last weekend, that it would be stupid, in his words, to increase taxes on wealth at the budget. Do you agree?
Well, it's an interesting question, right? So the real issue is, how do you actually spur growth in the country? How do you get the right level of public investment that actually expands productive capacity? And how do we then also measure that, basically, right? So Jim O'Neill and I actually wrote an article in the Financial Times over a year ago convincing Rachel Reeves to change the fiscal rules so it would actually allow that level of public investment that we require, which, by the way, is one of the lowest in the G7. We've had a very low public investment, very low private sector investment, which people forget about. We are one of the lowest in the OECD for the private sector investment share of GDP. So then the question is, where does the money come from? And you can focus on tax. And of course, we need progressive taxation. So we have the wrong kind of capital gains tax. I think we have the wrong kind of corporate income tax. But the point is not just to increase tax. It's to actually stimulate a tax system which also steers the economy towards long-run growth, towards inclusive growth, towards sustainable growth. So these questions of, you know, is it right or wrong just to increase one tax, and what is the right fiscal space, has to be done in a much broader conversation of what kind of growth we actually want in the country. And currently the problem is that the way the fiscal rules are designed are not going to actually allow the level of public investment that we need to also crowd in the level of private sector investment that we need. So the conversation has to be much broader.
Okay, well, let's put that point to Matt Pound, who was helping Rachel Reeves decide what the fiscal rules were until March in the Treasury. Matt, do you think that John Healey should stick to the rules as they are currently set out, as they were set out by Rachel Reeves?
I do. And I think it's important to remember the context in which they were written. Labour, like many other social democratic parties across the world, has a historic problem with being trusted on the economy. But I think that those rules are positive in a number of ways. One, they are intuitive. I think that people intuitively understand that you should be trying to balance day-to-day spending with tax receipts on the stability side. And they understand that very well. And then the second thing is, coming to Mariana's point, which I think we broadly agree, is that you should treat day-to-day spending differently from capital spending. And we ended the ridiculous farce under the Tories in which shiny projects were promised They never materialised. The money for those projects was then switched into day-to-day spending to plug spending holes, and those projects were quietly forgotten about. By changing the fiscal rules, it allowed Rachel Reeves to already borrow an extra $100 billion across the parliament to invest in the country's future. And she also had to take some very decisions, tough decisions already on tax and spend. Look, I think they were the right decisions to take and that they would have paid off over the course of the parliament, but we cannot pretend that they didn't have downsides. I think would say that for now, for John Healey to enter into a long discussion about the amount of borrowing that we have in the economy, having, you know, his predecessor having taken on so much of the heat for those difficult decisions at the start would be a very big mistake.
Okay, well, Mariana, Matt Pound talked there about the fiscal rules as they're currently constructed being intuitive. Do you worry that the kind of reform that you were calling for just a moment ago and that you write about is hard for a chancellor, perhaps especially midway through a parliament and a new chancellor under a new prime minister, to sell to the country?
So, I mean, I think the problem is intuitive for who? So the stability rule is intuitive for a family. But we know that, you know, a family household is different from a government household. Government can create money. It can especially stimulate an economy through a multiplier effect. So if by being stable, we end up kind of starving the economy of the kind of investment it requires, think of all the investment we require in productive transport, sustainable transport, a healthier population, a stronger electricity grid, a skilled workforce, a dynamic research ecosystem. All these things are the things that actually drive long-term growth. So forget short-term growth. Those are just blips. The long-term growth we need, which, by the way, is also from your previous interview just 10 minutes ago, which I thought was very inspiring, actually investing in youth centers, in a proper care system, thinking about future generations and the youth of today, where in so many parts of the UK really feel abandoned. That's about the long-term value in an economy, making people feel valued, which also makes them ultimately more productive. But that's not what we should be just thinking about. So the fiscal rules are not the objective. We need to have the right fiscal rules that allow us to make these kinds of investments, that allow all people in the UK to flourish, but also the planet. I mean, just look at the consequences of climate change right now that we're also feeling. That requires investment today.
Indeed. I just want to bring a different element to the discussion with Matt. I mentioned in the introduction the question of defence spending. Now, you know, you bear the scars of Rachel Reeves' negotiations with John Healey when he was Defence Secretary. Arguably, his resignation, saying that the government was not spending the amount on defence, 3% by 2030, 3% of GDP, which was required to keep Britain safe. Arguably, that was the coup de grace for Keir Starmer. How much of a political problem, as a political strategist, do you think it would be for John Healey if, in that first budget in October, he can't summon up the money to meet that demand that he made when he was Defence Secretary?
Well, I think the spending review is the normal place where you would lay out your plans for defence spending. And as I've already said, I think that the fiscal rules as they stand are, you know, there's enough space within them for him to be able to properly fund defence by reallocating within departments. And that's what I imagine he's likely to do. The issue with the budget is that if he leaves himself so little wiggle room. Now, Rachel, after the first budget, people may remember, didn't have a lot of headroom in the budget. We then spent a year building that back up again, which, you know, took on quite a lot of personal criticism for, but there is quite a lot of headroom in that budget now. The thing that I worry about on his side is that he runs that so low that then it's not credible. But look, I've got every faith that he'll do a good job and that he will deliver on defence.
All right. Matt Pound, former political director to Rachel Reeves, and Mariana Mazzucato, professor at UCL. Appreciate you joining us.
Now, the news that Roald Dahl's short stories for adults are to be magicked onto the small screen by Netflix will spark interest again in one of the masters of the form, but also in the form, short stories, itself. The short story is different, say its fans, and not just that it's shorter. It's a different literary form, one with a long history, but, say some, one that maybe in decline. Philip Hensher is a novelist whose new book, A History of the Novel in Britain, is coming out next week. Philip is also the editor of the fabulous anthology, The Golden Age of the British Short Story, which he dates as 1890 to 1914, a brief and glorious flowering. And Sarah Hall is a novelist and short story writer who's the first writer to have won the BBC National Short Story Award twice. Welcome to you both. Philip, can I start with you? Can we just get this clear? How short is a short story? When is it not a novella?
Well, I don't believe in novellas.
Right, okay, well, clear that up then.
I think it was set, really, by the great explosion of the short story, which is when the Strand magazine in the 1890s started publishing Sherlock Holmes, and they set the length of a short story at 6,000 words. Since then, it's sort of varied between 1,500, 2,000 words to 9,000 or 10,000 words. But it's a flexible
right.
beast,
okay.
the short story.
And Sarah, can we talk about the difference in the form between the short story and the novel beyond, obviously, the length? What are the literary differences?
Well, it's very hard to categorise a short story. I mean, as you've mentioned, they come out of this long tradition of oral history, you know, with a basis in folk and fairy tale. But they also sustain experimentalism and innovation. So, you know, you have palm fiction, flash fiction, found document fiction. It's a very, very sort of flexible form. And we can argue over word lengths, but that's sort of irrelevant. In some ways, it's about the content and the form working together to present a distilled drama, a compressed world, something that's going to slightly wrong foot the reader off and be subversive, provoke a reaction, give a great big experience, which is greater than the sum of the parts of the story.
Right. Philip, you clearly like the form. Can you explain what the joy of it is?
I think it's because, as Sarah says, they could be experimental. And the reason for that is when there was a magazine culture publishing short fiction, if something truly weird came through the post from an untried author, then nothing much would be lost if they just bunged it in the magazine. And so it could try all sorts of odd things out. It's a flavorful form, certainly. It needs to make its impact in in a short commuter journey. You know, the short story was supported in the 1890s and 1900s by all those clerks coming in from the suburbs who had half an hour on a commuter train. They wanted to read Sherlock Holmes, of course, but they also wanted to read some surprisingly sophisticated short stories, you know, Joseph Conrad's short stories, that sort of thing. So it's kind of explosive form, I think.
Sarah, do you think they work particularly well for screen adaptations? I mean, there is something about the immediacy of the characters and the pace of the plot that transfers well to the small screen. Do you think that they're naturals?
I absolutely do. I think adapting short stories for film and for TV dramas is perfect. And we've seen that, you know, Tales of the Unexpected in the 1980s. Mm. It's happened before. I think because a lot of them are designed to be read in perhaps one sitting, that translates to the screen as well. You know, you might be sitting down for 2 hours and you want a complete drama. And the short story is creating that for you. You know, the metrics are there. There are details there that are pertinent enough for the reader to be able to kind of evoke this world in their imagination, but not so much that everything is fully detailed like a novel. So as a reader, you come in and you begin to interpret, and as a dramatist, I think you come in, you see the details you need, and you do the act of transference to screen. I think they work beautifully together.
Philip, you have spoken of them as something of the past. Do you think they have a future?
Well, I think that literary forms are sustained by an active paying readership, and you know, magazines and newspapers very much have sort of steered away from publishing short stories in a regular way. I think the thing that could return interest to them is exactly that, a film dramatization. If people remember that some of the great films of the past, Don't Look Now, Brokeback Mountain, The Man Who Would Be King, are based on short stories. And if people went back to, you know, a great short story writer like V.S. Pritchett, say, and turned that into movies, it might create a new generation of short story writers and a paying readership.
We'll leave it there. Thank you very much, Philip Hentscher and Sarah Hall. Thank you.
5 minutes to nine, and it's 4 days since Dolly Parton's death, and still no shortage of tributes to her global impact on music, yes, but also on literacy and even vaccine development. But the Queen of Country was first and foremost a daughter of Tennessee. Tonight, the Grand Ole Opry, Nashville's iconic country music venue, hosts a memorial concert for a crowd of thousands, streamed online to many more. Dan Rogers is the vice president and executive producer of the Opry, where Dolly played more than 100 times over her 60-year career.
I was just a kid, about 12 or 13, and my Uncle Bill Owens and Carl and Pearl Butler had brought me to Nashville.
Oh,
most of the
gosh.
Artists at the Opry had two spots. So I just walked up to Jimmy C. Newman and I said, "Jimmy, I want to sing." So he told Johnny Cash that I was going to sing, and Johnny introduced me, and I sang my little heart out, and I just tore the house down. I know now it was because I was little, but I just sung it over and over and over, and boy, I thought then I was going to be a big star.
The Grand Ole Opry is the home of country music. We do several shows every week here in Nashville, Tennessee, and Dolly Parton grew up listening to the Opry, and I think forming dreams of country music career.
I want to introduce to you now a lovely little lady that's one of the finest new talents in country music. Let's give her a great big welcome right now. Pretty Miss Dolly Parton. How about it?
There's no way that girl standing on the Opry stage could have ever imagined what she was in for.
It was the 3rd of June, another sleepy, dusty tale today.
If you ask 10 folks who've worked at the Opry for 20 years or so, at least 9 of them would say their favorite Opry moment was when Dolly returned to the Opry stage to celebrate Porter Wagoner's 50th Opry anniversary.
No, that's exactly right. I think this is something we'd all like to say to Porter, but if it hadn't been for Porter, I wouldn't have written this song.
She came back that night, and she and Porter were both in white, and Porter was sitting on a stool center stage, and she sang for him, "I Will Always Love You."
And if I should stay, well, I would only be in your way. So I'll go, but I know I'll think of you each step of the way.
The Opry is the home of country music, and truly, in good times and in bad, this feels like the place to which people are drawn. And so we'll have just a big family out in the audience and on stage and backstage remembering their good friend and celebrating the music and life that she had.
That's all from us, though Dolly will go on. Our editors today were Laura Hendry and Tom Fielden. The studio director was Gabriel O'Regan.